But I think we've settled down now. Apologies that we stole a bit of your time. Our meeting is scheduled for 9. We do actually have in our presence colleagues, the executive director from the Trade Law Center, Ms. Trudy Hessenberg. And we do actually have a prof here with us, Gerard Erasmus, who actually are going to be able to assist us actually understand the kind of issues. The interesting part in terms of the title as well, to our special guest, is actually looking at the space where we're looking at regional, which actually connects us as South Africa, because sometimes we refer to as people who are not in Africa, as if we are a country elsewhere. So it's quite an important one with the recent kind of challenges we had, which are more socio-economic than political, which actually are quite important in this presentation, just to make some sense on how those relationships should be built, because there's no more serious political issues, but we actually have social and economic challenges as a continent. When you actually look at the recent past, it's issues about social and economic issues from my point of view. So we would actually firstly look at the apologies from the committee side. Andre?
Chairperson, there is no formal apologies, but just to indicate that Mr. Cuthbert is sounding late, he will join the meeting in within half an hour's time.
Maybe I actually should say that for the part of the committee business, we did yesterday have a walk down the road, and I actually think it will be important, because we had our committee meeting at a different venue than usual. And on the committee business, we're able to actually put on record what we reporting through the minutes of the committee, which we approved in that session. I think it's quite important that we are able to actually confirm as the committee that we actually have actually agreed with those sets of minutes that were circulated. Committee members were comfortable that it was actually a true reflection of the previous meetings we had. Because obviously, if you remember the WhatsApp, what do they call it, the app, parliamentary app, we may actually have to visit some of the things which are quite important are those records of what we are doing as a committee, how we actually record that. It's actually quite important. So I thought it will be quite helpful, just say outside one issue. There's an issue relating to training. There were forms which we distributed. I'm one of the culprits that have not finalized, but I did say to the Secretariat, I shouldn't leave this room today without submitting. I actually filled the form halfway, but I'll make sure I finish before I actually leave today. So I'll ask for committee members to do the same, because I think the capacity building part and the sense of programmatizing the kind of experience members are getting here, it's quite crucial. So I would like to ask you then just to speak to those from the Secretariat side so that we can be able to record and have on our program. Thank you.
Sure.
You want to make a comment first, Helmut, and then let's take Andre after Helmut. Yes, Floyd, yes?
For the record, some of us did submit our forms. We are not all delinquent like you.
I think I should apologize to the committee. Yeah. So I think they say it's only 5 members that have actually submitted. So Trudy Hermans is one of them. Hermans. You see, and he says you're making it sound too heavy when you say Hermans. So I said now I'm saying Hermans. So it sounds much easier. And, so Andre, so let's actually maybe pick up on that so that at least we actually summarize. So we should actually add to the 5 members because we are more than 5 here. Thanks.
Chair, the matter is being addressed. We are going to distribute additional forms this morning to members who didn't complete it, and we will not let members leave before they complete that form to ensure that we need to proceed with the process that needs to happen before in order to comply with what we discussed as a committee. Chair, with regard to the annual report, nothing is formally tabled yet. The tabling will probably happen when members are not in Parliament. So I just want to alert members that we will probably send electronic copies of that annual report to members, and it will probably be via my app, because it's quite huge, so it will be via my app. So members will have access to the annual report in preparation for the meetings that we'll have on the 8th and the 9th of October on the annual report. So members must either check the my app, and we'll probably, if there's problems on my app, we'll individually email it to members each annual report that. But just to remind members, the focus for the BRRR in terms of annual reports is the Department of Trade and Industry, the Department of Economic Development, it will be SABS, and it will be the NRCS. Those are the four annual reports that we'll consider as part of the budget review process. Doesn't mean that the other reports will not be considered, but it won't form part of that process, it will be considered later. So members must just check the emails and my app for that, for the source documents in preparation for that engagement when we come back. The Secretariat will probably prepare an analysis on these documents, and we hopefully will send it to members before members return on the 8th of October. Other issue is that we have submitted the program to the House Chairperson. Hopefully we'll get a House Chairperson currently in Japan with part of the rugby tour with the parliamentary rugby team. So hopefully we'll get a likely sign next week, and then we will then schedule those meetings on my app as well as the group wise, and members will know when the next session starts. Thank you, Chair.
I think when we come back, we'll be very close to the last 3 months of the calendar year. So obviously, we should be able to look at the end of financial year, which is next March, so that we actually get sense of what we actually put on our agenda. Maybe that will actually then help me to move to the next part of the program before handing over to our guests that are here today. I think mainly there's an issue relating to the program of the committee. In the overall, we would actually be able to look at what it is that we may need to do, because yesterday when we visited the one-stop shop, the big issue which came up was the working relationship among government departments, and on the other side, which was very glaring and very important, is the importance of three spheres of government working together: municipalities, provinces, and national. So those are things which actually were very clear. If we don't get traction at that level, we are going to have a lot of work which needs to be actually getting to those who are beneficiaries, which we will actually be not communicating among ourselves, and we'll lose out on that entirely. So can we actually then agree to adopt the agenda on the basis of what we're going to do today, and then we can be able to proceed, and then the A team will take over.
Chair?
Yes. Well.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. In terms of the agenda, we don't have an adoption, but there's a committee business. I think we must amend and adopt. Thank you.
I'll need a seconder of amend and adopt.
Yeah, I second.
Okay. It's amended and adopted. Mm-hmm. Then we can move on to the next item. Good morning. Mm-hmm. A-team, floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning, honourable members. And Chair, with your permission, we would like to have a very informal discussion today, so we don't mind if you interrupt us to ask questions or clarifications or add to the agenda of what we have covered. And you'll see the 1-6 point, honourable members, on the agenda is tea time. So I'm going to ask for somebody to remind us, because once we start discussion, we may actually lose sense of the time. Chair and honourable members, we have brought some materials for you. We have on a previous occasion distributed copies of this small booklet on the African Continental Free Trade Area, but we've brought copies again. Then in addition, we have a trade explainer. This is a glossary of all trade terms. It's a small booklet which we've also made available electronically. And it's really good news to hear about the app, because it's maybe possible to upload it on the app for members as well, so it is easily accessible. Then we have a final handout that we have prepared, and towards the end of our discussion today we'll have a look at that. In the news, and Minister Patel was talking to the House about the continuity agreement that has been signed between South Africa, Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, Eswatini, Mozambique, and the United Kingdom, initialed last week, let's use the correct term. And what we've done is just to prepare a document which takes a look at an overview of the SADC Economic Partnership Agreement, which in a sense provides the framework and the detail and the content for that continuity agreement that has been initialed last week. So that's the third item that we have brought for members to consider. But Professor Erasmus and I are not going to be bound by this. Do we have to speak into the microphone all the time?
It makes it easier.
Okay.
Yeah, when the shop steward voice doesn't go up,
okay.
You don't want to speak without mic.
Right. Let's do that then, because the two of us will do the presentation jointly, and we also interrupt each other, so you're welcome to do the same. So it's really an interactive discussion. We'd like to make this as useful as possible for members. So any new issues which are not covered here, please do ask us about them. So just to start off, honourable members, an overview, and we are starting from some really basic issues about international trade, about why nations trade, how they trade, and what defines international trade in the 21st century. And, of course, one of the important issues when one takes a look at international trade in the 21st century is the role of services, trade in services. And our economy, about two-thirds of our gross domestic product is accounted for by services. So, of course, we are also trading in services. And services are important in manufacturing activities. They're important as trade facilitators. So transport, cross-border payments, communication are all very important in facilitating cross-border trade. So extremely important to keep that in mind. We'll have a brief section just to focus on the trade policy instruments that are being used by governments, by sovereign states when they negotiate trade agreements. And these trade policy instruments will be very much the focal point. And of course, the one that we most often refer to is the import tariff. So the tariff very often has seemed to stage when it comes to the negotiations and in trade policy making, but of course there are many others, so it is important for us to have a look at it in that context. We will then have a look at multilateral trade governance, some features of the world trading system. I know that you have had a session on that already. We will look at it with respect to its relationship to regional trade agreements and Africa's trade and integration agenda specifically. So we won't cover what has already been covered in previous training sessions. And then we're going to take a look at Africa's trade and integration agenda. A focal point, perhaps, is the African Continental Free Trade Area, because this is currently under negotiation. although the agreement has already entered into force, and I think we have to keep that in mind. It is a very unique situation that we find ourselves in. The agreement has entered into force, but we have not completed negotiations. So it's a first. That hasn't happened before. Why did that happen? That's a really good question. I'm going to ask my colleague, Professor Rasmus, to come in on this one, too.
Well, it basically happened because you allowed it to happen. On a more serious note, technically, international agreements are legal instruments that must be negotiated between states. There's no world parliament. So they negotiate and negotiate, and in trade agreements that often will take years, till there's a final document. And that document has to be authenticated. Is the correct word. But there must be evidence proof that now the negotiations are over and we have got a final text that it is signed, that signature, the first thing. But that is not yet a binding agreement. Then the agreement must be dealt with by all the participating countries in terms of their national constitutional requirements on how they will ratify it. And in our case, Section 231 of the Constitution requires that Parliament must approve the text that was signed before it can submit it, be transferred to the depository with an instrument saying we are ratifying. And once the required number of ratifications, in this case 22, have been deposited, 30 days later, this agreement enters into force. Where does the 30 days requirement come from? That was negotiated as part of the requirement, that clause, on entry into force. So the entry into force clause of this agreement says negotiation, signature, parliamentary approval, depositing of ratification instruments. Once they are 22, 30 days later it enters into force. Now, this agreement is still being negotiated, certainly important parts. We will see in a while that this agreement consists of many sub-instrument protocols and annexes. So the agreement stands on the top, and then there are protocol on trading goods, protocol on trade and service, and dispute settlement, and there will be a second phase next year. The reason why this process has been conducted in the manner that it did happen was because of political, let's use a nice term, enthusiasm, last year. There was an extraordinary summit of the African Union in Rwanda last year, in March last year. Trudy was also there. And it was decided there that there must be a political confirmation that states are serious about this. And the political leaders then embarked on the process of ratifying their results. But this is not, let me say it in terms of how the technical requirements for international agreements are formulated in international instruments. This is not actually how it should happen. So we have adopted, or the political leaders have adopted, the process of confirming political commitment to this, but trade under this agreement cannot happen and is not happening before the outstanding issues of tariff reductions and rules of origin have been finalized. Have I answered you? Thank you, madam.
And also trade and services commitments have not been negotiated.
Just a question on that. The minister yesterday, Patel, indicated that where you currently don't have ratification, for example, with the SACOM UK agreement, you do have a memorandum of understanding that can kick into place so that trade actually continues between the countries. I just wanted to know whether this is the case with regards to the current matters we discussed.
No, this is not the case. The reason why the rollover, the continuation agreement between SACU and Mozambique on the one hand and the UK on the other hand can continue is because there's a history. The SADC EPA
is provisionally enforced since October 2016, and the UK was a party to that. We will come to Brexit. There are also other variations on this theme, and we will introduce them. What happens if on the 31st of October there is a disaster with Brexit? We will come back to that one. But there's a clear legal basis in the case that the minister was referring to, because of the purpose of this agreement with the UK is to prevent disruption of preferences that have been existing since 2016 already.
Thanks very much, Honourable Members. As you see, as the last item on the agenda will be Brexit, but we're also going to say a little bit about the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. Although it's not a trade agreement, we know that the current preferential non-reciprocal arrangement lasts until 2025, and that's 5 years away. Just more than 5 years ago, 5 years away. So we've got to start preparing for what happens after the end of that already now. So we put that on the agenda as well. So we will look at the current negotiations, so some of the ongoing negotiations in the CFTA, for example, but also take a look at domestic trade governance matters. So that's the overview, and let's start. The issue about how and why nations trade, we're going to do this in tandem. And I think, as we indicate here, trade has an extremely long history. It predates the nation state, the establishment of modern sovereign nation states as we have come to know them. And the reality is that individual countries, individual states, cannot exist in isolation. We can't prosper in isolation. Trade is absolutely essential to prosperity. And I think this is really, really important. So South Africa's integration into the global economy, our integration into the rest of the African economy, is absolutely critical. And what we are seeing, for example, and what makes the African Continental Free Trade Area so important, is the increasing importance as trading partners for South Africa. The rest of the continent is an extremely important market for Africa's agricultural products, for our industrial products, but also for our services. If we think about all our MTN, Standard Banks, Absa's, Woolworths, Pep's, exactly, all of them represented across the continent. This is an extremely important market for us. And part of our success on the African continent relates to the important relationship between trade in goods and trade in services, because our goods reach the consumers on the rest of the continent via wholesale retail distribution networks. It's the Pick and Pays, the ShopRites, the Woolworths, the Pep clothing that are actually selling South Africa's goods and providing services from South Africa's services suppliers to those consumers across the continent. So trade in goods and trade in services are very closely related, and that's very important to keep in mind when we look at our trade policy.
Just a small point. One would like to maybe get a sense of the entire space we might be looking at, because there's a bit of areas which are unregulated, or what might be informal, which may not actually be falling in the space, you know, counterfeit goods and other things. The point of what advantage we have in terms of having these agreements and how we can actually be able to minimize the negative impact on the other side, because there is actually quite a growing space of unregulated areas where there would be business which is not actually registered taking place across the countries in the continent. It's just as a comment.
Yes, thank you, Chair. That point is completely valid and is in fact covered here. So from my point of view, and I'm only a lawyer, it is important to emphasize that trade must be regulated and must be conducted between sovereign states. And for that, we need legal instruments. And those legal instruments are treaties, they're international trade agreements. These trade agreements have to be implemented on the interstate level as well as within state. So if negotiations are completed and goods can be imported at lower tariffs or under certain rules of origin or standard requirements, then they come and they will physically arrive at our border. Now, states are sovereign. The sovereignty is a big problem initially, or a conceptual problem. A sovereign state controls its own territory, it has jurisdiction over its own territory. So it can allow the movement of goods, persons, services, capital, and can regulate it and can prevent it. We often prevent visitors and important players in this regard by not issuing them visas. So there are interrelated consequences as a result of the fact that states are sovereign. So international trade agreements and agreements about any type of matter must regulate how sovereignty is reconciled with the acceptance by states of obligations vis-à-vis each other. Trade is reciprocal. What we want to export, others must be prepared to allow. If we want to establish a business concern, a bank or a cell phone operating in another country, it must be done in terms of the law of the host country. Now, so regulation of trade, the consequences of trade, the consequences of movement of goods, services, persons, and payments bring into the picture non-compliance, criminality. So the quality of trade governance that we are able to bring to this problem, governance, is vital for the extent to which we will reap the benefits in a predictable, certain, and enforceable manner. So if there are violations of the agreements involved or of private practices, counterfeit, or dumping of goods at unfair prices, what are the consequences? Are we capable of intercepting counterfeit goods? I saw figures a day or two ago about billions and billions of rands being lost to the fiscus because of under-invoicing and counterfeit. Now why, if you think practically, what happens at the border that allows that criminal activity to happen and to go undetected? Or, I don't know, we don't know, there are many, many reasons why that happens, but it's a very, very serious problem, and the evidence seems to indicate that we're moving backwards. So the conclusion of trade agreements is only the first step. The vital governance, regulating, enforcement phase that comes subsequent to that, that is increasingly an area of concern. It also has implications for Parliament, because let me just emphasize this point. International trade agreements, they are not self-executing. They secure market access on a reciprocal basis, but a trade agreement cannot be taken by an importer of goods to the local ministry or to the local courts and say enforce it. An international trade agreement must be domesticated. So if the goods come in and they are now entitled at a lower tariff, it means that the implementation of this trade agreement must have included a process of changing or adapting our tariff book in order to reflect the preferential treatment that will now be accorded to goods coming from African country X, because this continental free trade agreement says so, or that will be possible for goods originating from Kenya because the tripartite free trade agreement provides for that. So let me emphasize and concur with you, Chair, that the conclusion of international trade agreements, that's the fancy part. The real work, the real challenge, the real demand for supervision and dedication and making sure that there is good governance starts with the implementation.
Yeah, no, thank you. I just wanted to check on the trade agreement. It indicated that it also protects legitimate and national needs.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure whether national security is part of it, because if you negotiate it somewhere, you put non-barriers to protect securities and stuff. I just wanted to check
that. Yeah. Honourable Member, this is an extremely important issue, and I'm going to ask Professor Rasmus to say something about the US-China trade war, where national security interests feature very prominently. But what we also indicate there is that agreements must also protect legitimate public policy interests, human health, plant, animal health, and the environment. And this is really, really important because product standards are featuring increasingly important in terms of denying access for certain products to enter a market if they do not comply with the standards. And we're reminded, for example, honourable members, of the very, very sad listeriosis crisis we had not so long ago. So product standards, which are enshrined in the international trade agreement, are not a matter only for international trade, but also in our domestic economy to protect, in this case, human health. So product standards, extremely important. There are cases where they may be used to protect the domestic market, and one of the issues which honourable members have actually discussed is the so-called citrus black spot issue, where that certain cosmetic, say, spot on the orange may be deemed as a concern by a certain importing country and say, no, no, we can't import oranges that have those markings on them. But then we need to find the scientific evidence to say, is this actually a problem or is it not? In other words, is it legitimate to deny market access if an orange has some markings on it? So extremely important. But I'd like to ask Professor Rasmus to say something about the national security issues, because this is extremely important currently.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Member, maybe you should enlighten me a little bit about the manifestation of the national security concern that you have in mind, because there are many. There are those of high politics that we see in the WTO at the moment, and we can talk about them. And then there are those that may be related with the immigration, the enforcement of immigration regulations and law about the movement of persons across borders. What do you have in mind? Because it may influence the answer.
Professor, maybe one would think of the imposing of tariffs. One will think of the imposing of tariffs in the U.S. currently, stating that it's a matter of national security. And also we'll check as to what are they saying if they will narrow the flexibility of trade and barriers. And if you check the rules of origin, vis-a-vis the non-barriers rules, so I just wanted clarity on that one. Because if you negotiate on the first base or on the fair ground, you are able to say, no, this the origins in terms of the black spot is not needed. Initially, not while now we're exporting and we're importing, then you say, no, this black spot, you see. So I just want to check that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me respond as follows. First point, many of these exceptions, national security is an exception, I'll come to exceptions, we have borrowed from the WTO, and we also see them in our intra-African trade agreements, also in the continental free trade area. But the philosophy behind that is not difficult to understand. International agreements, trade agreements, create obligations. If you look at the WTO, it is a rules-based system. All the member states must comply with their commitments, and they must do so in a manner that will not cause discrimination. In other words, if a member A extends a benefit or a lower tariff to another member of the WTO, it must automatically be extended to all the other members.
system multiplier, the most favored nation treatment. You've encountered that concept before. And once goods have entered, there's a national treatment principle. You may not discriminate between imported goods and like national goods. But there are exceptions. International trade agreements, and the most obvious one is the WTO, allow for certain legitimate exceptions. So, if there's a serious threat to the national health as a result of the importation of certain foodstuffs, then it is possible under the SPS agreement of the WTO to say, I've got scientific evidence that meat produced through processes that will involve certain substances of causing mad cow disease or hormones are involved. I, as a member state of the WTO, may, if I do have the scientific evidence, disallow, not allow, goods for which I have a legitimate fear that they will cause undermining of the national health or the example that Julius mentioned. So that is an exception. If there's an unfair trade practice where goods are being dumped in another market, in other words, goods are being sold below cost in another market, that is considered by the WTO to be an unfair trade practice. And then measures, anti-dumping duties are permitted to be implemented against dumped goods. And so there are others too. There is that Article 21 of the GATT dealing with national security, where now for the first time we see the United States, but also other countries like Japan and others, invoking, and the first decision has just been rendered in a dispute between Russia and the Ukraine. For the first time ever since 1947, we see that Article 21 of the GATT discussing this very sensitive issue of the military side of national security being invoked in a dispute in the WTO. And we will have to see how that pans out. But let me summarize. The WTO and trade agreements generally allow for legitimate exceptions, but only under certain conditions. So if there is prima facie evidence that goods are being dumped, let's say chicken, poultry, is being dumped into this country from, and we've got a dispute on that at the moment with the EU, then the local importers or producers cannot run to the government, to ITAC in DTI, and say, dumping is taking place, you must take preventive measures. No, you can't do it that way. There's a formal, detailed procedure in the anti-dumping agreement about how the investigations must then be conducted, and the evidence must be identified and shown to exist, and you must show that dumping is taking place, that it is causing serious injury to the local industry. So if we haven't got a poultry industry, there's no concern about dumping. Then we're benefiting consumers. So there must be dumping, must be shown to exist. There must be serious injury to the local industry. And the injury must be caused by the dumping. So if there's injury to the local industry, but it has been caused by the drought or some other factor, then we are not entitled to impose an anti-dumping duty. And only after all those requirements coming from the WTO agreements have been investigated and applied in this matter can we lawfully impose an anti-dumping duty, but our decision to do so can be taken on dispute in the WTO, and it often happens. More than 50% of the cases in the WTO, and there are many, many, are about trade remedy measures.
Thank you. This is very interesting for me. I just wanted to know how amenable is South Africa, because I think we do more negotiating towards importing than exporting. I think my opinion is that we allow or we I don't know how to put it, but we basically subserve ourselves to other countries better for them to import than to export. How competitive are our tariffs for countries that want to import goods into South Africa? And also, understanding that there's a lot of dumping that takes place, there's a lot of criminality that enters, how are we controlling customs? Because I think maybe that's the bulk of the issue, is goods coming in through customs and being allowed inside the country. What action or what are we doing basically to do that? Because I think that's the bulk of the issue, is what comes into South Africa and how it comes in and how it's presented to us, which is why then we've got a lot of countries, which is impacting on our economy.
Thank you very much. That's an extremely important question, and I think Marga and team, if we have a future opportunity, it may be an idea that we look at the structure of South Africa's tariff. Because, of course, when we look at the tariff book, if we had a flip chart, we would draw it for you with the different columns. But it's on the SARS website. And if you take a look at the tariff book, it's basically a spreadsheet. And on the left-hand side, we have all the products that we trade. And they are classified in the Harmonized System, which is an international classification system, which makes it easier, of course, when we negotiate with our partners, because we all use the same classification. The most recent update of that classification is 2017. And then we have this list with the product description. So, for example, the Harmonized System is divided into chapters. And chapter 22 is about beverages. And you will find non-alcoholic and alcoholic beverages. Wine is under chapter 2204, for example. Clothing and textiles, you'll find chapters 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63. But every specific product has a code and a description. And then we have the list of applicable tariffs. The highest import duty is the WTO duty. So that is the import duty which is payable when we are importing, say, a T-shirt from China. Because remember, we don't have a free trade agreement with China. We trade with China under WTO rules. So at the moment, you will see in the little booklet, it just so happens that one of the tariffs that we have identified, which is up for negotiation, in the Continental Free Trade Area, it is page, let me just get my glasses, Honourable Members, page 19. You will see in the middle a box with South Africa, and for certain items of clothing, that WTO import duty is 45%. Mm-hmm. So if we are importing T-shirts in particular and a number of other garments, then the import duty is 45%. Now, if we are importing T-shirts from a SADC member state, remember we belong to the SADC free trade area, so we have negotiated tariff reductions. So we can export under lower tariffs to other member states, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Zambia, and others, and for them to export to us. And this is where the reciprocal nature of trade agreements becomes really, really important, because of course, we all want to protect our own domestic industries, but when we negotiate trade agreements, we both make concessions. So we both offer reductions in duties, one to the other. And so if we are importing T-shirts from Malawi or Zimbabwe, the import duty can be as low as 0% or 5% or 6%. So this is quite important to keep in mind. In the same way, if we are exporting T-shirts to Malawi, the import duty is pretty much zero as well. So the reciprocal nature of trade negotiations is very evident in our tariff schedules, our tariff book. So just coming back to what we find in the tariff book, the first column is the WTO duty. So this is where we would find the 45% under Chapter 62 for T-shirts. Then we would have a column which relates to the SADC EPA, the Economic Partnership Agreement with the European Union. And those tariffs would be much lower because we have been negotiating tariff reductions. There may be certain products which we excluded to say, you know what, we want to protect those industries, so we're not going to negotiate tariff reductions. And those are the exclusions that we talk about when we talk about our tariff negotiations in the African Continental Free Trade Area as well. And at this stage, 3% of tariff lines in the African Continental FTA negotiations will be excluded from liberalization. Those are our sensitive industries. We want to protect them. So we have a column for the SADC EPA, there's a column for SADC, and there's a column for the EFTA. So these are the countries in the European Free Trade Area, Norway, Liechtenstein, Switzerland, and so on. And then we also have a column for the Mercosur countries, including Brazil. So this is what the tariff book looks like. So once we have completed this set of tariff negotiations, we will get an extra column in the tariff book. That will be the CFTA column. But at this stage, we're not quite sure if it's going to be one column or if there may be many more, because we may negotiate separately with, say, the countries in West Africa. We may negotiate separately with a country like Ethiopia. Then we would have to have a separate column in that tariff book. But if members are interested, even at tea time, we can perhaps call up if we've got Wi-Fi here and just have a look at that tariff book. So that's the reciprocal nature of tariff reduction negotiations. I think, as we've got somewhere on the slide, when we look at tariff negotiations, we have offensive interests. In other words, that's where we want to get into foreign export markets. So we really want to promote our exports to certain markets. And there are our defensive interests, where we defend the domestic industry. And we may exclude some products from tariff reduction negotiations. In some, we may reduce by a small margin, whereas others, we would be prepared to negotiate significant tariff reductions and aim eventually for zero tariffs, because that's really what a free trade area is all about, is eliminating tariffs and non-tariff barriers. So...
That's the beginning of the comment.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, my follow-up question on that would be a fairly simplified question, firstly. So if a tariff of 45% is on textiles, clothing, and T-shirt, for example, from China, so that would mean the T-shirt is 10 rand. The T-shirt would then, the tariff on that would be 4 rand 50.
Yeah.
And that is what goes to who? Goes to government? So that's collected by government. All right.
That's right.
So what happens then when, and I think the minister alluded to this, where you have some unscrupulous traders who, instead of putting in the T-shirt cost 10 rand, who would write it down as 10 cents. And apparently this has been done.
Absolutely.
So instead of the T-shirt now costing 10 rand, it's been written down as 10 cents. And so you're paying a 45% on that, which is 4.5 cents. How do we prevent that from happening, number one? And obviously that speaks to regulation and implementation of our regulations, and I believe that they are there. But then the second thing is with regards to that tariff agreement that we have 45%. If a country like China then decides to set up a factory in Mozambique,
yeah,
that we have a relationship with, and we then import T-shirts from Mozambique at no tariff. Do we have a handle on that? And are we winning in that score? Thank you.
These are such important questions to have a look at. I think, as a member here mentioned while you were describing the situation of the pricing and the costing from the exporter side, this is under invoicing. And the impact is not only on the government coffer, because we get less tariff revenue, but it means that the T-shirts are coming in at a much lower price, and they're therefore offering a lot of competition to the domestic producers. Now, the consumers may not complain about that.
Yeah,
so somebody benefits from that. But this is a significant problem because it is fraudulent. That's really important. So what SARS will do when they take a look at their risk analysis and risk assessment of exporters exporting to South Africa, they will take a look at the history of that export profile. So for example, have we done searches at port of entry, say in the Cape Town port or Durban or at Oliver Tambo, where we've opened consignments of goods that are valued at a particular price, and we look and we think, no, no, this absolutely is not possible. In other words, that's really important. So SARS does a lot of screening of imports, and this makes the customs and border management function of SARS so important, extremely important. But this problem, particularly for clothing and textiles, became so pervasive and so pernicious, impacting tariff revenues so much, that SARS a few years introduced what they called reference pricing for certain garments, like jeans. Because what they were seeing was that huge consignments of jeans were coming into the country valued at 10 rand, 20 rand, 30 rand per pair, which is impossible. So they said, fine, if you've declared a pair of jeans, the value of that is 10 rand on your invoice, we will open the consignment and have a look, and if it is in fact jeans, we will use our reference price and determine the import duty accordingly. So this is really important. SARS tackles the problem of under-invoicing of a whole range of other customs and related fraudulent activities in different ways. So this is really important. Strengthening customs and border management, the capacity of SARS, is absolutely critical to managing our trade relations. But also, it has implications for the fiscal revenue. And so the relationship here, and I think this is a very important issue, the relationship between trade policy management, and fiscal policy is critical. It's really a very important policy connection. So I'm sure that the committee cross-references some of these discussions with colleagues in the Portfolio Committee for Finance, because I'm quite convinced that they would be looking at these issues as well.
It's trade policy management, and
fiscal policy. Relationship, because although if we look at tariff revenue, it contributes currently about 4% of the overall government revenue. But it is important. And it's not only the revenue issue, but it's the impact in the domestic market. Because some small clothing producers may not be able to compete with those extremely cheap imports. But the counter, of course, there is that the consumers benefit. So we have to weigh up all of these impacts, and that's really important. The final part of the question relates to essentially rules of origin and the country of origin. And the rules of origin are like the national passport of a product. So every product that comes into the South African economy has to have a rules of origin certificate. Now, the rule of origin certificate indicates where the bulk of value was added to that product. And different trade agreements have different ways of formulating what the rule of origin is. And that's really important to keep in mind. So we look at some detail as an example for the CFTA a little bit later. Now, if a product says that it was produced in China, then the customs officer at the Cape Town Harbour will go to the tariff book and say, country of origin, China. We go to the tariff book. What is the applicable tariff? It's the WTO tariff. But as you point out, if the country of origin is Mozambique, then we look at the SADC tariff, and it's a different tariff. So what you describe, Honourable Lemba, about a Chinese company locating its production in Mozambique, this happens so much in terms of the global industrial restructuring. and I hope that this will be on the agenda for the discussion on industrial policy, because it is so, so important. Many countries are looking at how they can get better market access, and then offshoring or establishing a commercial presence elsewhere. This is how, honourable members, Lesotho developed its clothing industry as a result of AGOA. When AGOA was promulgated in 2000, Lesotho is the least developed country, and it, under AGOA, has duty-free, quota-free access. And in terms of the rules of origin for clothing and textiles, it can source inputs, fabric, yarn, buttons, zippers, and so on from anywhere in the world and get duty-free access. Mm-hmm. So what happened was Lesotho actively marketed this, and first came investors from Taiwan, then came investors from China, more recently investors from Malaysia, and most recently, some South African clothing producers have relocated to Lesotho. So the issue of origin is particularly important, because that origin certificate will determine what the applicable tariff is. So, so important that we have a look at that. But if the company is legitimately established in Mozambique and complies with the SADC rules of origin, then the import duty may in fact be zero, as compared to 45% if it was produced in China. So these are really important issues, bringing now together industrial policy issues and trade policy issues. So we're starting to see some very important policy linkages when we look at trade and trade agreements.
Just a small point, one was just saying products, or what we're good at as South African. We actually had a quote at some point, local as lekker. So a sense of what are products we have as South Africans, and in terms of actually being able to compete and be able to actually trade, what is actually issues, which are challenges, or what would be opportunities when you look at that, because that's quite important, so that the reference we're making is on the basis of developments and challenges we face as of now.
Right. I think that's a really important question, and I think at a meeting that I observed not so long ago, I think one honourable member mentioned that globally now, 1 in 10 oranges consumed comes from South Africa. The National Agricultural Marketing Council has recently published a study on the citrus industry in South Africa, and it's a success story. Despite challenges like the citrus black spot, it's a big success story. We are producing, just looking at the very nice platter on the table over there, ladies and gentlemen, if we go to the supermarket now, citrus is not just in an orange, an archi, and a lemon. There are so many other citrus fruits and varieties, soft citrus fruits and so on. This is really a success story for South Africa. Apples, the export of apples from South Africa has increased exponentially to Africa. But we find it difficult to export to Japan because they have a lot of standards issues, sanitary and phytosanitary issues. Exporting apples to China is also quite difficult, because the standards issues are problematic. So, Chair, when we look at competitiveness and we look at opportunities for South Africa, we find them across all areas of production. But we have to look for them, identify them, and to see where we are competitive. So when we are producing, for example, industrial goods, say consumer goods, we are competitive in African markets, but not in Europe or not in America, because the high-tech products that are produced there, we don't have that capacity yet. So when we take a look at opportunities to develop, so fancy cell phones, for example, and so on, because we actually haven't got the scale economies and the technological development and know-how yet to produce those at scale. But if you come to an economy like the Western Cape, the ICT-related industries, the hubs, are flourishing, but they are producing services, writing software and coding. And they are coding for some of the big companies like Amazon and so on. So there's some success stories there too. So, Chair, it's really something we have to invest a lot of time in, is finding the areas of economic production where we are competitive and where we have potential to develop, because that's where job creation will come from. And that's how we can also attract foreign direct investment. So,
you said it's not easy for us to export apples to Japan. What is high tech about apples?
It's not high tech. I said it's standard, honourable member. It's the standard. The Japanese market is very, very close to agricultural imports because they produce their own agricultural products, so they protect the domestic market. And the tariffs are not necessarily very high, but it's the standards. So the standards that you have to meet in order to be able to export. And you may ask, so what are the standards about? They relate to, for example, the use of pesticides and herbicides, the packaging, the labeling. Those are really where we see standards issues becoming increasingly important. And the Japanese market is a difficult one for us to export agricultural products to. The rest of Africa is a much easier market. It's closer. And also we have the advantage of our retail and wholesale distribution network. So it can go through ShopRite or Woolworths and so on. So we have a ready distribution network, which we don't have in Japan or in China for that matter. So I think when we look at our trade relationships and our trade performance, very, very interesting to look at how services, the logistics, the freight forwarders, those companies that are actually assisting our farmers to export, for example, are actually helping us to be competitive in certain markets. So services, I think, are really important in this equation.
We have about 15 minutes
before
tea. So we would actually then allow that you actually sort of take us through a bit, because the discussion is actually very, very hot. But maybe we should actually be able to allow, because on some of your issues you present, some of our questions may be answered, so we try and allow you to proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Nothing prevents you from inviting us again. I want to make an obvious contribution, and that is governments conclude these agreements, they negotiate, but governments don't trade. So it is very important that we look at the relationship. If we ask, why are our apples not going to particular countries? Now, the apples are not being produced by the government. The apples are not exported by the government. But the privately produced apples, and if we can produce more of them, we can have the benefits of employment and growth. There's a government on the other side that has a measure that prevents them from coming in. We have measures preventing goods from coming in. Go and speak to the producers of raw honey in Zambia, and they will tell you they're extremely unhappy about how we block the exportation of their products. So we will at one point have to look critically at the relationship between governments and the private sector. How can governments, and this government, and you, what can we do, our governments do, to facilitate trade, to make it easier, and to do something about the criminal side of fraud. Under-invoicing is a criminal offense. Are we tackling that criminal problem with sufficient resources and vigilance and capacity, or are we closing our eyes to corruption and to criminal behavior? So governments have a particular role. And then I would also like to say, there was a question by one honourable member about the impression that the countries want to export to us all the time, and there might be a concern about that. Trade negotiations, if all countries in the world are getting involved into trade negotiations on the basis of, I want to get optimal market access to you, but allow you as little as possible here, we'll have no trade. That's the reciprocity. So trade is a trade negotiations are complicated, but as Trudy said in the beginning, we cannot flourish in, or we cannot prosper in isolation. But the questions and the contributions have indicated that with the opening up, with the global environment reality, with that comes all the additional governance implications that we must regulate this process. And when it comes to trade and services, we have now discussed only trade and goods. But the real challenge lies elsewhere. Intellectual property, trademarks, standards, services, regulations, illicit money flows, etc. The spectrum is wide. So many benefits, but many governance and many policy challenges come with that. Let's go through the three.
I think really we can do this quite briefly because some of our discussion has touched on this already. Honourable members, this is just an overview of trade policy instruments, both for trade in goods but also trade in services. And we've already mentioned that the import tariff is such an important trade policy instrument, also because it generates government revenue. But it's a very effective way of protecting the domestic industry, and that is because it impacts directly on the price of the good in the domestic market. So if we are importing a t-shirt from China and the import duty is 45%, that's a pretty high barrier. It may, in some cases, and China's perhaps not a good example here because we still get the t-shirts coming in from China, but say from the European Union, or another country that we don't have a trade agreement with, a 45% import duty would make that such an expensive, domestically sold product. So the import duty can prevent import competition. But often there is confusion about what the import duty, the tariff, can do. And I'm reminded of 2015-2016, when this is a very sensitive product for all countries across the world, is sugar. We were looking at an application to ITAC to increase the import duty for sugar. And a number of different players in the sugar industry had made submissions to support that application. And one of them was a small-scale woman farmer from the north of Durban, round about the Tongaat area. And she told a very compelling story. She said, I'm a new farmer, so I'm a land reform farmer, and I'm a woman farmer, and I am producing sugar. And I face two serious problems. The first one is a reliable supply of energy and the high cost of energy. The second problem, she said, was the minimum wage. I'm backing to cover my costs because my wage costs are high. And in her concluding paragraph, she said, please increase the import tariff. Now, ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, the import tariff will not solve ESCOM's problems, and it will not address wage and productivity issues. So we must be very clear about what an import tariff increase can do. It can offer some protection to the domestic industry, but it's temporary. Its effect is temporary because it does not address other issues that may actually be hampering the domestic industry. So we really have to understand when we take a look at the use of the import tariff, we may have to do other things as well to help that domestic industry. So again, it indicates the relationship between trade policy, industrial policy, labor market policy, addressing skill shortages, whatever the case may be. So quite important that we keep that in mind. Non-tariff, sorry, Honourable Member.
No, thank you. I just wanted to check in terms of the protection. rules to protect. What is it that we can do at least to protect, as we have indicated, the flooding, the dumping, and the challenges we have in the sugar industry is very indicated. Because the dumping for sugar from Brazil, while we're having our own challenges. Do we have processes of waiver where you can be able to waiver or block the market or what? And what are the processes moving forward? Thank you.
I think, remember, as Professor Erasmus has indicated, if there is an allegation of dumping, then there is a specific process that can be followed. And that means that we have to make an application to ITAC to undertake an investigation. And that's really important. This is one of the important roles that ITAC has to play, is if there are allegations of dumping, then they will undertake, they will initiate an investigation, which will take a look at whether there is in fact dumping, whether it is causing serious injury to the domestic industry, and if there's a causal link between those dumped goods, the dumping, and the injury. And if that is the case, there is a remedy. We can increase the import duty, for example. So there is a remedy in which in fact uses the import tariff to address dumping. But of course, once we've done that, as Professor Erasmus has indicated, if we are introducing an anti-dumping duty on sugar coming from Brazil, they may contest that. They may take a look at the investigation report of ITAC and say, no, you have not done a proper job of this investigation. There are problems with your analysis or with your data. We don't agree with that. They may challenge it. And they may actually take us to dispute settlement. So quite an important issue.
Yeah, may I just add, given the fact that Brazil has been mentioned as the example, Brazil doesn't have to dump it. Brazil is blessed with the land, water, and agricultural resources that allows it to supply practically the whole world with sugar and soya beans. So if it comes from Brazil at lower prices here, it will not be because of dumping. It will be because of certain competitive advantage that they have. And we will not be able to protect ourselves if we have opened up that market, or if they can produce sugar and export it at the WTO rate, the MFN rate. Their benefit, their advantage lies elsewhere. But sugar, let me just add, is a very complicated example. It is the only product, by the way, for which in the SADC trade protocol there is a separate annex. So sensitive it is.
Annex.
A separate annex.
And this, I think, the point that Professor Erasmus is making are really important. In the SADC region, there are a number of sugar producers. So Swaziland is a very, very important one, but Malawi, Zimbabwe, they all produce sugar. Mozambique produces sugar. So there are a lot of countries that have an interest in sugar. And it's sensitive for everybody. And the reasons are, it's extremely interesting because although there are economies of scale by having large sugar plantations, sugar can also be grown by small growers. And in a country like South Africa, but also in Swaziland, Eswatini, and a number of others, it has become an extremely important industry for small-scale farmers and a very successful way of empowering small-scale farmers. So it's linked to development concerns, job creation, empowerment. So the sugar industry is a really, really important one, but also a very complex one. And globally, I think, as Professor Erasmus indicates, there are some countries that, as he indicates, some are blessed with agricultural potential and so on, that actually can produce agricultural products, including sugar, at really, really low cost. Thailand is another one. They've become a big sugar producer in recent years. Turkey is another one. So apart from the traditional sugar producers globally, there are new producers that have become really competitive. And in the European Union, they don't grow sugar cane, they grow sugar beet. And they have recently changed their agricultural policy on sugar. They used to have a quota allocation for producers in the EU, but that came to an end in September 2017. And now, there's much more sugar being produced in the EU. So some of our exporters, and also Mauritius, which still produces a lot of sugar, we all used to export a lot of sugar to the EU, but they're now producing their own, so we don't have that kind of market opportunity anymore. So sugar industry globally has become very, very complex. Very complex one, difficult one. Non-tariff barriers, and I think in a discussion on non-tariff barriers, we should also mention that there are legitimate public policy instruments called non-tariff measures. And these are the standards we were talking about, which are adopted and implemented and also negotiated in international trade agreements for legitimate public policy objectives to protect human, animal, plant health, the environment, and so on. And that's really important to keep in mind. But sometimes these legitimate public policy instruments can become non-tariff barriers. Like the citrus black spot is often discussed as a non-tariff barrier. So it's a standards issue. Standards, when it comes to food products, are absolutely legitimate. But depending how you implement them, they may actually become barriers. Other barriers, non-tariff barriers, are often associated with customs and border management. The complex documentation, the delays at border posts, these are often non-tariff barriers that hinder cross-border trade. So non-tariff barriers are a very vast collection of different instruments and also practices, the way policies are implemented, the way our borders are managed. We actually had a meeting yesterday and we showed a slide where there was a queue at the border between Zambia and DRC. Trucks standing 40 kilometers and a queue at the border post. That's a non-tariff barrier. Because it means cost for your exporters, cost for your importers. It's actually hindering trade. And you can imagine if you are exporting agricultural products, which are sensitive to heat and to time and so on, awful to think about the consequences of you standing in a 40-kilometer queue. But our chemical industry producers and exporters are battling with these queues as well because they are carrying highly flammable chemicals and so on. And if they've got to stand in a queue sometimes for 3-4 days in heat, those volatile chemicals pose enormous risk. So these non-tariff barriers we've got to look at very carefully because they are eroding our competitiveness, increasing the cost of trade, making it difficult for us to export but also to import. So that's really important. Quantitative restrictions, these in the World Trade Organization, we as the member states, and it's really important, honorable members, to keep in mind that the World Trade Organization is a member-driven organization. We, as member states, have negotiated those agreements. It's not the WTO sitting in Geneva telling us what to do. There's no policing of those agreements. Member states are policing. We're watching each other, and we're taking each other to the dispute settlement arrangement. So that's really important. We've agreed in the WTO to eliminate quantitative restrictions, but they are sometimes still featuring in the tariff rate quotas, for example. So in our agreement with the European Union, there are certain tariff rate quotas. So we can export 110 million litres of wine duty-free. But if we export more than that, there will be a duty charged. So there are still quantitative restrictions for certain products. And the tariff rate quota means you're combining a quantitative restriction with a tariff. And so important to look at those tariff rate quotas in the SADC EPA because we're not using all of those duty-free opportunities. We're not exporting any butter duty-free to the EU, for example, and cheeses and so on. So these are quite important. Trade remedies and safeguards. The trade remedies, anti-dumping and countervailing measures. So anti-dumping we've discussed. Countervailing measures. These are measures which we can implement. When we take a look at a situation where the producers in a particular country are being subsidized by government. Now, subsidy gives an advantage to those producers, which we don't have. And that's deemed to be unfair trade practice. So if we can prove that that subsidy is actually giving the producers an advantage, and we simply can't compete as a result of that, so it's causing harm to our domestic producers, then we can implement countervailing duties. It's much less seldom used than the anti-dumping measures. Safeguards are not about unfair trade, but they are increases in import duties, for example, that we can implement if all of a sudden, when we implement a trade agreement, we see imports surging, becoming really, really growing very fast. And that import surge causes challenges to domestic industry. It's a really important one because it's not unfair trade. It's simply that trade is increasing so fast and it's such an impact on our domestic producers that we need to take some action to protect the domestic producers. So that's a safeguard duty. Again, it's an import tariff that can be used. Standards, I think we've talked a lot about those. Technical barriers to trade, those are the standards that apply to industrial goods. So, sorry.
You said some countries that subsidies on their agricultural products are a threat to the domestic market. What instrument can we use to counteract this?
That's very true. Some countries, when they have big government coffers, can actually subsidize their domestic industry. Now, only certain types of subsidies are permissible in terms of the WTO governance framework. But even if they are using permissible subsidies to support their domestic industry, it gives those producers an advantage over us. And so if those products are now exported to us, our domestic producers, which don't get necessarily the same kind of subsidy support, may actually battle. Then we can implement, if we can go through the investigation, the proof, so the whole process that is required to prove that it is that subsidy that is causing the advantage and that is disadvantaging and causing injury to our domestic producers, we can increase the import duty on those products. That would be a countervailing duty that we can institute. So that's really important. So it's a bit like the equivalent of anti-dumping. When they're dumping your goods, we can have an anti-dumping duty, raise the import tariff. In the same way, if they are subsidized products coming into our markets, we can raise a countervailing duty.
But it requires a thorough investigation.
Absolutely. It's got to be, it has to be rules-based. I think this is really important. So
it must be rules.
It's rules-based. And what would happen is that a company or perhaps a number of companies in South Africa would make an application to ITAC and they would say, we are experiencing difficulties. These products are coming in. They are subsidized. Mm. And they would have to give a lot of information to support that allegation. ITAC would evaluate that and then determine whether, in fact, it's worth them committing resources to do an investigation. And they would then do a thorough investigation and come to a conclusion and make a recommendation to the minister to say, we've done the investigation and we've concluded that in fact these subsidized imports are causing serious injury to our domestic industry. We recommend as ITAC that the import duty be increased. And the minister would then decide. And once the minister has decided, of course it goes to Treasury, because they changed the tariff book. So the countervailing duties, the anti-dumping duties would also be in the tariff book. They would be noted there. And that's really important because this increase in duty, whether it be an anti-dumping duty or countervailing duty, that information is so important for the importer. Has to be transparent. So that information must be in the public domain. Otherwise the importers won't know that they would be paying a higher import duty on those products.
10 minutes break is quite important, because I wouldn't like you to have a iced coffee. We serve it warm most of the time. So maybe we can break for 10 minutes and then restart again. Thank you.
That's a good idea.
I don't
No, I have it with milk, no sugar. She's being very good. Let me tell you.
Your mother.
Yes, I got my mother.
With
my mother's in the
You know what I'm taking?
Moringa.
I'm doing nothing but, you see, my tongue is going.
It's in powder.
M-O-R-I-N-G-A.
It's a powder or a tablet.
You get it in powder, but I pick the capsules.
You take one of the clothing more.
One morning,
one
afternoon,
night.
Yeah. And then stay. Yeah.
They have a name, Jesus. The cotton name is Jesus.
Oh, that one. But that was because you know Jehovah's Witness. Jehovah's Witness
of Jehovah's
I was going to call.
Hey.
That's something important.
It's also a very sensitive one.
Thank you, Nan.
Lots of honey from China.
And some of the products they produce are not natural. They are, fake is not the right word, but they produce eggs in a factory. They produce peas in a factory.
Wow.
Honey in a factory. When we mentioned sugar, I thought, he's going to
Comrade, Honorable Mantashe is back there.
Okay, but he also, isn't he in your corner about sugar?
I love the topic.
You know, sugar is such an interesting industry, also because it's a little bit like tobacco, because a lot of people are using less sugar now for health reasons, and that's why we've got a sugar levy. And of course, you haven't.
Yeah, so she's also taking the
sugar. So it's also consumers that are changing the demand for sugar. So the market, I think, is changing quite dramatically.
They must go into fuel.
I think so. I think it is shrinking. From the Trade Law Center. But we monitor ITAC. We monitor the applications and also the investigations that they do.
In this case of sugar.
Yeah. You know, at this stage we haven't had a complaint from the sugar industry to say it's because of subsidies.
They were saying that to us, and we could not have because we don't.
Yeah. So there's a current investigation, because the tariff was increased about 2 years ago, and then we're supposed to wait 3 years. But now the industry is coming and saying, you know what, we can't wait that long until 2021, I think it is. The sugar industry is in trouble now, so please can you do another investigation? So ITAC is discussing that with him at the moment. But it's a tough one because it's been very important for small-scale development.
We have a meeting that starts at 1
in KZN, which is my province. A lot of women as well. Definitely. Yeah.
No,
I'm sure we're ready to start. We will try and actually be as close to 1300 hours as possible, so that we don't. And we know that for members, it's a situation where you have no lunch or tea time, just work continuously. So there will be those who have other commitments at lunchtime. So we'll try and actually just say maybe give 5 minutes before one. Floor is yours. You can continue.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think this slide, which really takes a look at the trade policy process, but also some of those trade policy linkages with other policy areas, we've discussed some of these in some detail already. And I think there's some bigger picture issues here about how trade policy features in our national development plan. That's obviously really important. Chapter 7, for example, of the National Development Plan talks about integration into Africa, which is really where we are going with our presentation very, very shortly. So we've talked about linkages with industrial policy, fiscal policy, services sector policies are really important. And just one example to show how they link to trade and services. And that is, for example, whether we open our services markets to foreign companies to come and establish here to provide services. The establishment of foreign banks, for example. The regulators, the sector regulators play a very important role in this regard. So they are, when we look at the overall trade policy process, very important when we talk about trade and services. Because the regulators, say in the communication sector, ICASA, or if the financial services regulator, they are the ones that issue licenses. And they may, for example, in terms of legislation, after policy discussions have determined that only 4 licenses may be allocated, say, for mobile telephone services suppliers. And that means that only 4 companies may exist in South Africa to provide those services. This means that foreign companies that may want to come and establish here to provide telephone services, mobile services, may not be able to get in because all the licenses have been allocated. So the relationship between sector regulation and services is so important. There are also, of course, the Reserve Bank and the financial services regulator have prudential regulations to protect our money at commercial banks, for example.
But the opposite is happening in South Africa. Like, if you say we only issue licenses for protection purposes to South African companies like Vodacom. Vodacom is not a South African company. MTN is not.
Yes.
But we reject new innovations from our own people. Why?
This, I think, again, this relates to what is happening at the Department of Communications and the sector regulator, because that's their territory. They decide, the Department of Communications determines the sector policy for development of the communication sector. So they set the policy guidelines. Those are then translated into bills and laws and regulations which ICASA implements. So this is why, again, a committee such as this probably cross-references with the Committee on Communication, because those are issues that will be discussed there. So you're absolutely right. Already, even in the banking sector, in the communication sector, in so many services sectors, we already have foreign services suppliers. Now, some of them have come into the domestic market via a merger and acquisition. So they didn't come up and set up a new business, but they bought into an existing company. For example, this is how a Chinese bank became part of Standard Bank. And some years ago, Barclays Bank, which is now left, became part of ABSA. So this is really interesting. So again, we see a linkage between trade and services, and competition policy, because that's merger and competition regulation, which is relevant there. So the focal point of this committee has so many connections to other policy areas that we've got to be alert to and to monitor what's happening in those sectors. And we've got to know what is happening in the sector regulators. Now, very often the sector regulators know much more about a particular services sector than, with due respect, a trade department, because that's their territory. They focus just on that sector. And this is why they will be consulted by the Department of Trade and Industry when we come to trade negotiations, because they would know what the regulations are and help to inform our negotiating strategy, which DTI is responsible for. So quite an interesting one to have a look at. Investment, I think this is an important one, and it relates to this example of Barclays investing in South Africa, buying part of ABSA. That's foreign direct investment. Mm. So again, the link between sector regulation, investment, trade, competition policy issues, they all come together when we look at a transaction such as that. So really, really important. I think we'll skip the rest, and if we have time, we're going to come back and discuss some of these. But this was what makes the work of this committee so interesting, but also quite challenging. Multilateral trade governance. Perhaps we can do a very summary story, because I think you have already covered this. If Margot's here, shall we skip this one, or are there particular issues? Harris, you wanted to say a couple of things about this?
Yeah, could I just say something about the very last bullet? What is happening in the WTO? Is it in a crisis? Should we be concerned about that crisis? How important is the WTO for us in this country and on the continent? The WTO is in a crisis, and that crisis is a consequence of changes in the global picture. I don't think we should be tempted by allocating guilt. The WTO was established on the 1st of January 1995. The world now, in 2019, looks a lot different compared to how it looked then. A lot of technological developments, a lot of political developments, the dramatic rise of China as the number two economy in the world resulted in shifts in power relationships and in structural relationships. There is a crisis in the WTO, and that crisis is on a political level because of the tensions between the US and China. Those tensions would have been there in any case, irrespective of whether the WTO or not. It's just a simple reflection of the roles that they play in the global economy. How that is going to pan out, we don't know. But next year, for example, by the end of this year, because of the non-cooperation of the United States and the appointment of new appellate body members, we will not have a proper functioning a dispute settlement system in the WTO any longer. So there are concerns about that, but the world has moved on. And two final observations about the WTO. The WTO, I've been at meetings where I've been asked, are you a supporter of the WTO? Because that is that's the devil reincarnate. The WTO is not a policeman. The WTO is not even capable of making laws or of taking policy issues like the European Union Commission is. Why? Because it is not a model of integration and supranationality. It is member-driven.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever happens or does not happen in the WTO is a consequence of the ability of the 164 member states to agree or not to agree on new developments, on new agreements, and they will deal with those issues as dictated by their national interests. So let's look at the WTO for what it is. And in Africa, to some extent, we have the same, a repeat of the same. The African Continental Free Trade Area says in its agreement that it is a member-driven arrangement. The AFCFTA is not there to result in this new equivalent of the EU Commission. We in Africa don't believe in supranationality. It has downsides to that approach. So I just want to pause a moment and say our model of regional integration in Africa is not the same as the one that we have in the European Union. Our governments are very, very sensitive about losing their sovereign policy space and granting regional institutions powers to decide on their behalf. And we are, let me just remind you about that, because I have some fun in sharing that with you, personal, sinful fun, and that is we in SADC is the only regional economic community that decided to abolish our tribunal the moment it ruled against one of the member states. So there's a well-functioning tribunal in COMESA, there's a well-functioning tribunal in ECOWAS and the EAC. We had one in SADC, and then it had the audacity to apply the law and ruled against Zimbabwe. And what did we do, our government? They came together immediately and they abolished it.
You don't send a lot, don't they?
You don't know me well enough. There was a consequence to that one. There was a consequence of that one, and you're all aware of it. Our Constitutional Court has recently ruled that South Africa's participation, support for that resolution to abolish the SADC tribunal has to be withdrawn, and there was compliance. Whether that will bring us a new tribunal is a completely different story. Chair.
Okay.
In the interim, in the absence of the appellate body, where do we appeal now? There's no appellate bodies in the WTO.
I think there's already a decision.
Is there already a decision? Because the decision is that what we decided has been withdrawn or ruled against. Is that the position you're explaining?
I think this honourable member is asking about what will happen in the WTO if the appellate body is
nothing.
Yeah, and then you added a beautiful phrase, which is really encouraging. Where will we go to appeal?
Mm-hmm.
That would be making history, because African nations have never been involved in disputes in Geneva. So we will first have to get into those disputes before we can appeal.
Mm.
But that aside, there are desperate efforts up there in Geneva to try and find ad hoc, case by case, answers to that problem. But the dispute settlement dilemma of the WTO is very, very, very serious. It may mean, and when we have time, we can talk about that more. But there are other related problems. What we really must ask, why is the United States so opposed to the function of that body? And it goes back to the time of Obama. It's not something that Trump has discovered, by the way. the concerns of the United States about how the WTO is making law through dispute settlement is their philosophical concern, and there are some countries that support them. And they're also saying there are practices by China that are not being dealt with and addressed to the WTO because of their unwillingness. Things that relate to the stealing of intellectual property, as they allege, and some other practices. So let's just park it there. It's a big problem. And it is not impossible that if we meet in 5 years' time from now on, that multilateral trade will be regulated by different ad hoc bodies, as opposed to this one single multilateral structure. Or that we will see, and that's probably more likely, that in the WTO, the plurilateral agreements, you see, there are a number of agreements, like for procurement and for aircraft, that are also under the umbrella of the WTO, but they are not part of the single undertaking. They only apply to those member states that are party to them. And there are already indications that in certain areas like e-commerce, we will probably see developments in the WTO where only the convinced will conclude agreements and they will move on. And the danger then is that we have a fragmented multilateral system. But consensus, this requirement that new agreements must be adopted by consensus, has been identified as an increasingly difficult challenge. How do 160 plus countries across a very wide spectrum of needs need consensus? And I believe that in your previous trade sessions you were told about the WTO Doha round and that it was not concluded. Why was it not concluded? It was not concluded because of fundamental differences about concerns like special safeguards for agriculture that India had put on the agenda and that others were not prepared to agree. So, difficult times ahead.
Thanks. I think the issue of the Uruguay round, first round 1997, I wanted just to check whether it was converted from being an ITO to the WTO or what? Well, there was an ITO established in 1944 around there, or is still there, or we still have ITO and the WTO in the process. Thank you.
Honorable Member, if we go back to the end of the Second World War, the Bretton Woods Conference, which was held after that and led to the establishment of what we now call the Bretton Woods Institutions, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and there would have been a third institution, the International Trade Organization, but it was never established. And it was not established because the U.S. Congress could not support that. So what happened instead was a number of countries actually agreed to establish the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. So they entered into an agreement to manage and to regulate and to liberalize international trade. And what has happened after 1947 is every so often there has been a round of negotiations to take this process of international trade governance and liberalization forward, a Kennedy round and many, many other rounds. And the Uruguay round, this is the one to which you refer, which started in 1987, and it took about 7 years to complete. And at the end of those negotiations, and they were really important, because moving on from the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which the focus, as the name indicates, was on tariff liberalization, the Uruguay round negotiations also took a look at trade and services. So we have not only agreements on trade and goods in the WTO, but also on trade and services and on intellectual property, the TRIPS agreement. So in the Uruguay round, the member states actually agreed to expand the trade governance agenda. So we actually have much broader trade governance. So the ITO was never actually established, but it was envisaged at the end of the Second World War. But on the 1st of January 1995, the World Trade Organization was established. And so we have the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. We've got the Trade in Services, the GATS Agreement, the TRIPS Agreement, and we've got the Dispute Settlement Understanding, where the appellate body is really in trouble now. At the end of this year, there will be one member, and she's a lady. And of course, you can't have a functional appellate body with only one member. So that's part of the dilemma that Professor Erasmus has outlined. So quite important to keep those developments in mind. But keep in mind that in the WTO, both in the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, but also in the General Agreement on Trade and Services, there are provisions which allow for exceptions, and in particular that permit countries to form regional trade agreements. And so this, when we take a look at the African Continental Free Trade Area, we take a look at the SADC Trade Protocol and so on, that's really making us come and look at what we as member states of the WTO have agreed as the rules which permit that we can deviate from the non-discrimination principle, the most favored nation principle, and offer specific preferences to some of our special trading partners, as we've done in SADC and as we're currently negotiating in the African Continental Free Trade Area. So there are rules, WTO rules, which we've got to comply with when we enter into agreements such as that. That's really important to keep in mind. Domestic trade governance, I think we have actually talked quite a lot about that. Let's skip this one for now. Here we are, the regional trade agreements, economic partnership agreements. So when we take a look at the preferential trade agreements, regional trade agreements that we enter into, very often we are negotiating a free trade agreement. But there are also customs unions, and these are really, really important to distinguish. A free trade area, and the AFCFTA will be a free trade area. Longer term, the ambition is for us to have an African customs union, but not just yet. So we are busy with the free trade area negotiations at the moment. And in a free trade area, we are reducing tariffs. We actually want eventually to eliminate. We want no tariffs amongst those member states. But in order to make that free trade area work, we need rules of origin. And this is to prevent the problem that Honorable Sring mentioned earlier this morning, and that is transshipment. So we don't want a situation where we have an African free trade area, but a country with which we don't have a preferential trade agreement tries to get the benefit, so ships its product, say, to Egypt, and they slip into the market under the African Continental Free Trade Area, find themselves in our markets, and compete unfairly with our product. So the rules of origin will prevent that, because the rules of origin certificate for the CFTA will have to specify that the T-shirt or the apples or whatever it might be must be of country origin, one of the AFCFTA members. Otherwise, it does not get the lower tariff that we are busy negotiating at the moment. Very important, Professor Erasmus mentioned sovereignty earlier today, and I think that's really important. Sovereignty and policy space issues, they really go hand in hand. Most member states, and South Africa is included here, are concerned about their policy space to make domestic policy and regulation. So to maintain the right to regulate and make policy, and that's really, really important. Now, if a country enters into negotiations to conclude a free trade area agreement, it agrees with the other countries it's negotiating with to lower tariffs on trade amongst them. But it retains the policy space to enter into trade agreements with other third-party countries. So it retains policy space on the import tariff.
That's really important to keep in mind. When we look at a customs union, and the oldest customs union is the one we belong to here, the Southern African Customs Union, SACU. So South Africa, Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Eswatini. We belong to a customs union that was established in 1910. It has, of course, evolved over more than 100 years, and the current agreement is from 2002. It entered into force in 2004. But a customs union, honorable members, is characterized by two features. There are no barriers to trade, no tariff barriers amongst the member states. So it's a common customs territory. It's almost as if it's one economic space. That's really important to keep in mind. Very, very important. So within the customs union, if we are taking, say, wine from South Africa to Namibia or to Eswatini, we can simply take the wine, drive across the border. They might check the VAT, because keep in mind that SACU is a customs union, but it is also an excise union. But when it comes to certain areas of tax policy, we don't have the same rates and the same policies. So the rates of VAT differ among our countries. So, for example, at the border, and Professor Erasmus often makes the trip from Cape Town to Namibia, they will check and say, you're bringing so many bottles of wine, and if the VAT rate differs between South Africa and Namibia, as I think it does, then they would either give you a refund or you would have to pay the additional VAT that is required. But there are no customs duties. So there are no tariffs on the wine. So there are no trade policy instruments. The VAT is a fiscal policy instrument. It's a domestic tax policy that has to be paid. So that's really important to keep in mind. But the second really important feature of the customs union is that it has a common external tariff. And it means that whether a T-shirt is imported from China and it's arriving in South Africa, or it's arriving in Wolfish Bay and going to Namibia, if that T-shirt is coming from China, the rate of duty is 45%. So all the SACU member states basically have the same tariff policy. And it's for that reason that SACU member states have to negotiate trade agreements with other partners, including in the CFTA, collectively. Because South Africa can't go and say, but you know what, let's lower the tariff for some of our partners in the CFTA. But Namibia says, no, we want to maintain the tariff at the level it is right now. We adopt the same tariff policy position in a customs union. That's really, really important. So the integrity of that common external tariff is absolutely critical. And this is why in the SACU agreement, for example, it says, and this part of the SACU agreement has not been implemented, is that the member states should establish a common negotiating mechanism so that they can speak with one voice very easily. Now it happens a little bit on an ad hoc basis. So in the SADC-IPA negotiations, the country leading those negotiations on behalf of all of us is Botswana. When we enter into other negotiations, it may be South Africa or one of the others.
Common negotiation, what?
Common negotiating mechanism.
Which one? There we go. I just want to ask with regard to the ACFTA and the fact that in sub-Saharan Africa, we're one of the few countries that have something like RTAC, for instance. Where's the discussion leading at the moment in terms of what is going to form that kind of a similar body? And, you know, what kind of opportunities are there for us to use our expertise to maybe benefit ourselves in a particular way?
I'm going to ask Professor Erasmus to answer that, because he has served on the Technical Working Committee for the AFCFTA negotiations on trade remedies. So on the issues related to ITAC, and he can share that experience with us.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. It's very important to remember that ITAC is one of the oldest institutions, national institutions, used by a country to investigate applications by the private sector and sometimes government to change the tariff, about rebates, and in particular about trade remedies. Those earlier examples of the poultry, if the local poultry industry or the sugar importers are concerned about products being dumped or subsidized and then imported, they know that it is possible to take trade remedy measures or countervailing measures against those goods, provided the investigation is undertaken in terms of the law, applicable agreement. And you're quite right, Honourable Member, that so that it is claimed that there are only two countries in the whole of Africa, South Africa and Egypt, that have fully functional trade remedy bodies. We call them, in WTO terminology, we call them investigating authorities. But they are only entitled to act on behalf of their own member states. ITAC also acts on behalf of SACU, because it's a customs union, and because there was a decision to that effect adopted by the SACU Council. But if we want to have a proper regime for trade remedies under the Continental Free Trade Agreement, and there's a whole annex about that, then there are two serious implications. And that is that the member states, the 55 or 54 that will join the AFCFTA, will have to adopt laws and will have to establish investigating authorities. It is also to be noted that the disciplines that have been adopted for the AFCFTA trade remedy chapter are those mostly of the WTO. And we in South Africa insisted on that being the position. So the implication of this high level of ambition in the AFCFTA to have a proper rules-based regime when it comes to trade remedies will need to be translated into follow-up action by the member states across the continent, in terms of which they can have the laws and the institutions to do that work. I want to mention, however, that recently Trudy and I have picked up that there are two African countries, Madagascar and Zambia, that are increasingly imposing safeguard duties. And they are newcomers on this score. On where do they get the expertise from? It is actually not necessary to start from a point zero and to establish a new investigating body. A state can use its existing institutions. Many countries use simply the Ministry of Finance, the customs officials, or they can do it ad hoc. We should not overestimate, or we should not, let me put it out this way, we often hear the excuse that we can't, in Africa, we can't impose trade remedies because we haven't got the capacity. That's not a convincing argument. If Zambia and Madagascar can do it, and many other smaller countries, then we in Africa can also do it. So I think it's a matter of governance, and it's a matter of recognizing the usefulness and importance of trade remedies as a means for rules-based trade remedies, as opposed to discretionary measures, playing golf on a Saturday afternoon with a particular buddy from the private sector, and on Monday you've got restrictive measures or a refusal of a permit. So rules-based trade, if that is the way, the good, the sound way that we want to go on the Continental Free Trade Area, will have inevitably consequences for governance, for legislation, for technical capacity, for institutions. And that's a very good thing. That's sound, and we should support that.
It's good for trade, and it's good for country.
And it's good for investors and the private sector and for us as consumers, if there's transparency, if there's certainty, if there's predictability.
just wanted to check how going to function without a body, like for instance the African trade without this body. How are we going to be able to function and be able to investigate and then put remedies if they need to be? Thank you.
Honourable, that's a really interesting question. If we think about what Zambia did, Zambia actually has a desk within the Ministry of Trade, Ministry of Industry, Commerce and Trade, that is designated a particular official to be the focal point for these investigations. So applications from the private sector are made to that desk, that individual, that officer who's responsible for this particular task. And then the investigation is undertaken by a team of experts. And I think as Professor Rasmus has alluded, it could be government officials who undertake the investigations themselves in the Ministry of Trade or Finance. But what they can also do is to brief a consulting company, Deloitte or whoever they might be able to use to conduct that investigation in terms of the applicable law. And if they, as Zambia and Madagascar both use the WTO safeguards agreement, that law is absolutely clear on how the investigation should be conducted and what it needs to prove. So the information that has to be gathered and so on, it's pretty clear what needs to be done in those investigations. So it doesn't have to have a separate institution as we have, the International Trade Administration Commission. And it can simply have a department or an office or a desk within an existing ministry that becomes the focal point for tariff-related investigations. Because keep in mind that the function that we're talking about also includes, for example, the kind of application where a company would like the import duty on a particular product to be increased. So it's also by tariff amendments, increases or decreases, or a rebate. So where the tariff is not actually changed, but a particular industry may say, but we want a rebate. We want you to waive the duty on a particular import because our industry is battling at the moment. Then the overall import duty doesn't change, but specific companies can apply for the rebate and import those inputs duty-free. So the function covers all tariff-related trade policy instruments, actually, the tariff itself and amendments to the tariff, but also trade remedies and safeguards, which are also about the import tariff, essentially. So that's quite important to keep in mind.
Just for the sake of not oversimplifying this whole issue around the rules-based requirements or the institutional legal requirements for rules-based trade governance when it comes to remedies, we have also seen that in many, many countries in Africa, the real obstacle often is lack of reliable data. If you think through the practicalities, if there's an application for, let's say, a safeguard duty, then it must be shown that there has been an upsurge in the importation of a particular good as a result of the a certain trade agreement entering into force. How does one prove an upsurge in the importation of a particular good? You need reliable data. Where does the data come from? It must come from the national institutions that have to collect trade data, like customs officials, like your statistics officers. And we often hear, as we do our work in other countries on the continent, that capacity to collect, refine, and use reliable data in a comprehensive manner is deteriorating. And I think that is a real concern, because without proper reliable data, policy making becomes a major problem. And one of the concerns that we should watch out for also in our part of the world in Sakwa and in our own country, is the reliability of and the collection and the capturing of data, which will impact on these other bad practices such as under invoicing, corruption, illicit money flows, and all of that.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to find out, the Prof mentioned that Egypt will have a similarly established, you know, their version of ISAC, shall we say. Do they have any other countries that they provide the service to, and how many countries, which countries are they? And then just lastly, if you look at, and I'm maybe being a little bit cynical here, but it seems as if the South African approach is that we want free trade on the continent, but we want protectionist measures elsewhere, because we want to develop some form of hegemonic power over the rest of Africa. And I do add the claim that it is cynical. But from your opinion, would you say that South African trade is largely liberalised, or is it more protectionist from a, you know, a technical point of view? I think it would be interesting to see what your guys' perspective is on that.
So the question is, how are we doing? And as South Africa, are we opportunistic in this space? Or are we really coming in as true partners with real benefit out of this arrangement?
Certainly, we'll answer this one. What is being wrong with being opportunistic? The problem is if everyone is opportunistic.
We'll have no trade.
I think this is really important. In recent years, we've seen a lot of countries become inward-looking and adopt more protectionist measures, both tariffs but also non-tariff measures. If we look at South Africa's history of trade liberalization, when we joined the WTO in 1995, we made a very bold liberalization offer. So for about the first 5 years, when the WTO was established after that, we reduced our tariffs quite significantly. But from the late 1990s, we've seen that we've become a little bit more protectionist. But generally, South Africa is an open economy. There are products where the import duties are high. There's no doubt about that. And very often that reflects the industries which are sensitive from an industrial development perspective. So motor vehicles and automotive components, clothing and textiles, sugar. These are perhaps the three most protected industries. And what we also find is steel products, for example. You find that over the last 5-6 years, we've had a number of applications to increase the import duty on steel. So there are a number of products which are sensitive from industrial development perspective, and we see that in the tariff policy recently. Yes.
Just a follow-up on that. So if we, I don't believe there's a binary to say we are the protectionist or we are, you know, completely liberalised in that way. But if you had on a sliding scale, would you say we lean more towards protectionism or we lean more towards liberalisation?
I think we are creeping towards more protection. And it's not surprising, we're not the only ones that are doing that. And some of the reasons relate to jobs, employment, and the prospect that you may actually, when you liberalise, put some domestic producers at risk, the ones that are not competitive, and so jobs may be lost. But liberalization sets in motion a transformation process, which is actually extremely important. We want to transform the structure of our economy, and lowering tariffs will cause pain, but there may be longer-term gain, so we've got to handle it really carefully. And this is where the support policies, when we do liberalize, become really important. So the lady I mentioned who was asking for tariff protection in the sugar industry, you know what? Addressing Eskom is a fundamental issue for industrial development. Our competitiveness is reduced significantly as a result of the unreliability of supply and the price of energy. And energy is an input into all economic activity. So just using the tariff and being more protectionist while not addressing other fundamental issues will paint us into a very, very tight corner and reduce our competitiveness significantly. So this is where these policy linkages, and I think this is why we've spent a bit of time discussing these policy linkages. What are the real problems inhibiting South Africa's competitiveness in agriculture, industrial development, and in the services sector? And it's complicated by the fact that there are important linkages. Services sectors are inputs into all economic activity. Energy, transport, communication, financial services are inputs in all economic activity, from small micro farmers to large multinationals. And if our transport, our ports are not functioning effectively, we've got high port charges, we're hampering competitiveness. And that's a services issue. It's an infrastructure issue. It's a regulatory issue. So we have to look at all of these issues in a context. The import tariff cannot address all of our economic challenges, and I think that's really important to keep in mind.
Okay. I would actually allow you to move on. The debate and discussion, I think it's quite important, but if everyone can just allow a bit of movement, because in the debate we're going to actually have more time to actually engage. I don't know how we feature as South Africa in the global space, in the continent space, and what we doing, are we making any progress, and what will be the best way forward? Because those are the kind of things we're trying to actually look at. Challenges are there, but literally, where we at, how are we doing moving forward?
Chair, thanks very much. Just to pick up a couple of other points on the slide before we move on, we're dealing with some of the terminology here in trade policy, and all of this is captured in that small trade explainer. So we've looked at a free trade area, customs union, a common market. This is where we liberalize trade in services and the movement of factors of production, labor, capital, payments, and people can move across borders freely. That's a common market. So very important, because that's about trade and services essentially. Very, very important. But when we look at trade agreements, we often now see that they are called partnership agreements. The SADC Economic Partnership Agreement, for example. And this is increasingly common when we take a look at trade agreements that are being concluded. Very often they go beyond just trading groups. They include trade and services. They may include investment, competition, intellectual property issues, as does the Continental Free Trade Area. But they may also include certain development provisions. So in the SADC EPAC, there are a number of provisions where the EU makes available assistance to us. So we can ask for money and we can ask for technical support, technical assistance. And we can use that to increase the quality of our laboratories, our testing facilities, to meet the standards that are necessary to get access to those markets. To date, we haven't used any of those facilities, which is a great pity. Regional trade governance and integration. We're now looking very much at, and we're going to focus here very much on the African integration agenda. And as we mentioned earlier, the WTO agreements allow free trade areas and customs unions under certain conditions, and that's really important. And Harold, do you want to say something about GSP, Eva?
No, you're better than I am.
That's not true. I'm not a lawyer, but ladies and gentlemen, when one takes a look at the systems, the frameworks, the agreements, the arrangements under which we trade globally, we find that there's the WTO, this is really the big picture, the umbrella, so to speak, but then there are other arrangements such as the Generalized System of Preferences, and these were introduced in the early 1970s, 1971, it was a suggestion by UNCTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, and they proposed that developed countries and large developing countries can actually, or they should, offer duty-free, quota-free access to exports from other developing and, in particular, least developed countries. So, for example, the European Union, Canada, the United States, Australia, many, many others have generalized systems of preferences. So a lot of our exports to the US go under its GSP arrangement. It's not a reciprocal one, so it's not a trade agreement. So every year, the US decides which products from eligible developing countries can enter the US market duty-free. And in that sentence, we see that it's a little bit uncertain because we don't know. They might change their mind because there may be domestic lobby interests that say, no more oranges next year on the GSP list. So it is not a robust trading arrangement, whereas a trade agreement that we've negotiated, it's rules-based, and there are remedies if things go wrong. We know how to settle disputes and so on, for example. So very important. So there's the GSP. Then there's everything but arms. And this is a really important arrangement, also non-reciprocal, that the European Union introduced for least developed countries, in particular in Africa, the Caribbean, and the Pacific region, where it has colonies. And under everything but arms can be exported duty-free from these least developed countries to the EU. But there are rules of origin, and some of them are a little bit complicated. So we don't find a lot of uptake of that duty-free opportunity into the EU. The Africa Growth and Opportunity Act is also a non-reciprocal arrangement. We didn't negotiate this with the US. I think, ladies and gentlemen, that's really important. It's a US law first signed into law by President Clinton in 2000, and it's been renewed a number of times. The most recent renewal was in September 2015, and it's for 10 years. So in 2025, it comes to an end. And what the US is currently doing is to see whether there is an African country or maybe more who would be willing to negotiate a free trade agreement. So come the end of AGOA, what happens then? Very important question for us. So after the AGOA forum, we know Minister Patel and senior officials at DTI were meeting with their US counterparts in the Ivory Coast and discussing, should we, let's talk, and so on. So quite important to keep that in mind. But all of these non-reciprocal agreements, they require a waiver approval from the WTO membership because they do not comply with the non-discrimination principle. So they have to be approved by the WTO membership, and that's really important. So against that background, let's take a look at regional integration in Africa. And honorable members, regional integration for Africa makes absolute sense. We often talk about Africa as if it's almost one country. The reality is the continent consists of 55 member states. It's a fragmented continent. Some are very small countries. Some have no borders to the sea or access to trade routes, for example. So they are landlocked or land-linked, as some analysts like to call it now. But small countries, small markets, small economies face specific challenges. All of our countries across the continent face challenges of poverty, inequality, unemployment, and in particular, youth unemployment, gender exclusion. So we look at financial services. Women are very, very much not on a par with men when it comes to access to financial services, having bank accounts. And in the ICT, the digital economy, having access to mobile phones and other ICT services. So the African countries, all 55 of us, face a lot of challenges, but we are diverse. South Africa, no longer the largest economy on the continent, but the most diversified, the most developed, and that's really important. When we compare our infrastructure to the rest of the continent, other countries on the continent, we far surpass what is available in other countries. when we look at our financial services sector, it is well developed, it's robust, domestic regulations are implemented effectively, there is an institutional architecture to monitor banks, to step in when there are problems, as we've seen in recent times, for example. So the South African economy is, and is also, and honourable members, this is really important, it is perceived by many people across the continent as the country where there is economic opportunity. And as a result, we do see migration towards the South African economy. And the very unfortunate and very sad, very tragic issues that the chair referred to earlier, the xenophobia we see, is a major, major challenge for us. We are part of the African continent. We cannot ignore that. And where there may be risks associated with influx of people, there are also potential benefits. Skills that we may not have, for example, in South Africa and so on. So it really is something we have to handle very carefully and with great consideration. So given that background of a fragmented continent, from an economic perspective, regional integration makes absolute sense. We will create larger markets, we can improve our competitiveness, lower the cost of production and trade, reduce the cost of transport, the waiting time at borders, all of those kind of things, if we integrate effectively and if we implement what we agreed to in our negotiations, because implementation is one of the big challenges when it comes to our integration arrangements.
Could I just add a point which I've learned from Trudy, and that is 66% of all intra-African trade in goods is conducted here in the tip of Southern Africa, in the SADC region. It has two implications. It tells us how advanced the trade liberalization and production has become here in the Southern African tip, and it also tells us another thing, how extremely important the African markets are for us. We cannot do without them. It's certain. And this, by the way, isn't the insight of a lawyer. I learned it from Trudy.
Honourable members, this is one of the slides which demonstrates exactly what Professor Rasmus is saying here. We all know that intra-Africa trade is very low by comparison with other regions. We're looking at kind of calculated to be about 17% of Africa's total trade. That means that a very large part of Africa's trade is still with the rest of the world in commodities. In commodities, that's really important. Coffee, cocoa, gold, lots and lots of mineral commodities are being exported. But when we look at the intra-Africa trade, it's concentrated here around South Africa. It's concentrated around South Africa. More than half the intra-Africa trade takes place in SACU. And we were reminded not so long ago that if we take a look at South Africa's major trading partners, then two really small countries in SACU, Namibia and Botswana, are in literally the top eight of our total global trading partners. They are major markets. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, we need SACU. The SACU market is critically important for South Africa. If these two small countries come just after the United Kingdom and Germany and China as key trading partners for South Africa, that tells us how important SACU is for us. More than 65% of the total intra-Africa trade takes place in SADC. So Southern Africa matters for us, but at the same time, we have a lot of opportunities in the rest of Africa. Lots and lots of opportunities. But we face challenges. For example, our trade with Nigeria has been increasing in recent years. And it's been increasing because they do not have petroleum refining capacity. So we import crude oil from them, and it actually comes to Cape Town, to our refineries here. And then, exactly, and then we send it back to them as a refined product. But a lot of producers, even in the Western Cape, are exporting a lot of products, wine for example, but they encounter a lot of problems. In order to export a product, they have to register it locally, and it can cost $10,000 to register one product to get access to that market. And another problem is that the Naira, which is the currency of Nigeria, is a very thinly traded currency, so it's not always possible to change the Naira into dollars to get our money out. So some key wine producers from the Western Cape region are stuck with a lot of money in Nigeria. So what are they doing? They're almost forced to invest in other things, property development and other things in Nigeria, because they can't get their money out. Access to foreign exchange is a major problem. So some of these issues, honourable members, are when we take a look at the African Continental Free Trade Area to say, are they addressing the real problems to intra-Africa trade? So it's against that background that we're going to take a look at.
Yeah, maybe Chair. So we move back. I hear it.
We can move and then we can comment still. Go ahead,
Mbuyan. Yeah,
because we want to actually get moving. So, but the floor is yours.
The power of the chair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very
true. I understand that Africa has the capacity to take over the process moving forward in terms of trade. But in terms of performance, in 5 years' time, South Africa has declined. I don't know what happened, because if you can check in terms of the comparative advantage, South Africa has declined for the past 5 years. If you can elaborate more on the decline.
Thanks very much, Honourable Member. I think when we talk about declining and other countries that are prospering, to some extent, we can objectively, as economists, analyze that. We take a look at whether our industry is growing, whether more jobs are being created, where exports are growing and so on, and that's really important. But it also is relative, because on the African continent, honorable members, there are some countries that are shaping up really fast. And in recent years, we have seen, for example, investment in the motor vehicle industry going into Nigeria, into Morocco, into Rwanda, and Peugeot has come into Namibia. And their investments in Zimbabwe, which used to have an auto assembly industry years ago. So what we are starting to see is that many countries on the African continent are taking their industrial development, their agricultural development, their services sector development really, really seriously, and starting to create policies, trying to attract foreign direct investment. So they are increasing their capacity, their competitiveness, and also starting to improve their trade performance, which is really, really important. So when we look at growth rates on the African continent in recent years, some of the 6-7 fastest growing countries globally are in Africa. Quite a number of them are in East Africa, the Rwandas of this world. Some are in North Africa. But the countries that are lagging behind in terms of growth on the African continent are the big ones, Nigeria, South Africa, amongst them. So when we look at the average growth rates on the African continent, then we and Nigeria are bringing that average down, and the smaller countries are growing faster. So when we look at competitiveness and performance, yes, we have to watch our economic indicators really well. Are we creating jobs? Are we attracting foreign direct investment, as the President has put an ambition for us to do that? Are we attracting new technologies and developing new industries and so on? But at the same time, we've got to look at what other countries are doing as well, because they're not waiting for us. they're actually, they've got their development pathways and strategies, and they're working really hard to develop their economies.
There's a loaded implication in this statement of yours, Tugi, and by the way, we are also permitted to differ. If she says, are we attracting investment? Are we attracting modern technology? Who are we? Who are we, and how do we attract? For me, it means there is a complicated, comprehensive, and an honest assessment that has to be made. When the chair asks, how are we performing? I think this is the type of issue that now comes to the table. And governance and the policies and the messages that go out from our country as a whole and from our economy and how that is being, for example, interpreted by the rating agencies. That will have serious and direct implications for can we solve the problem of ESCOM? Can we solve the problem of SOEs? Where will the money come from? Can we service debt? What is the component, the percentage of that debt and all these factors, and that comes to some extent on your table, is about how we are being governed, because governments, although they don't trade, they play these absolutely vital roles in tackling the problems that are now part of the package of how do we attract, how do we perform. And we are in a serious difficulty. You will probably know it better than most other people. But there's also history, and the implication of that is that we will have to jointly come up with a plan and a resolve and a commitment to do that, and a parliament and a portfolio committee performing the oversight function has to be part of that activity, and it must be well informed and it must play a role. But for example, if I would be watching TV in another African country and I see trucks being petrol bombed on the national roads in this country when they move merchandise across the borders this way and that way, that will send out a very, very not only serious but also an unnecessary in-the-face type of message on the TV screen that we can do without. So when Tudy says trade policy is a comprehensive interrelated activity that goes to so many government departments, the we that have to deal with your concerns about declining performance is an equally integrated, bold and very challenging task where many, many activities, policies and players will have to come together.
Chair, just to take that conversation a little bit further, and it comes back to the point we made earlier, governments do not trade, and what we really need to look at is investment, because what we want is private investment to come to expand our productive capacity. And when you take a look at how investors make their location decisions, do we set up a factory in South Africa, in the Western Cape, or Gauteng, or KZN, or do we set up a factory in Namibia next door? Then these governance issues become incredibly important.
Or in Botswana, where they give
Botswana.
You the land.
There we go. We are competing with so many other locations. We are competing with East Africa, which really is enjoying so much focus at the moment. And so when the President says we want to attract investment, it's quite a tall order, because the investors will look at all of these issues. They will look at, do we have skills? If we don't have skills, how easily can you bring them into the country? Can I get a work permit for an expert which is not available here? So they look at all of those kind of issues. And that is really, really part of this bigger package of creating the governance environment, the policy, the regulatory environment. the economic and policy conditions, governance conditions, which will attract investment and promote our capacity to trade.
Because I think the point you raised is, was to say big economies in the continent, South Africa, Nigeria, not doing well. And then the definition on our part is to say we are diverse, we are developed, and further you say perceived to have economic opportunity. So there's factual inaccuracy on who we are and what's possible and what's to be done. Because eventually what is natural is that intra and inter is an issue which is our future. If we don't look at it that way, we can't do everything within our borders. So which means we should look at the issue of economic opportunity regionally and in terms of continent, and be able to actually know where the strong points are and how to build that to our own benefit. Because if ever we are able to invest where the border, because at this point it's only citizens of this continent that are doing it economically and socially, because they actually have to survive. But in reality, when you look at those borders, they've been long been actually removed, because socio-economic issues are making people to be everywhere in the continent in a big way. And on our part is that we're with the whole ocean at the other side and all the borders around us, even if we build capacity, it will be practically impossible to actually stop movement of people who want to survive. So I'm just raising that as a point to say, the reality of our situation is slightly different. Maybe we should speak more to what role we have as a country to play in creating opportunity to be able to actually get the development. And our definition, as you put it, to be different. We should be part of the economy, and we should be able to know where the strong points are for our part, and actually get support to those who actually can do better than us on other areas, in a way that we look at the regional economy in a way that we complement each other and we can be able to grow this space. Because outside that, I think we're stuck on the same thing. Because the more we compete on similar issues across our borders, the more slow we are going to be in terms of moving forward. I'm just saying it's a simple opinion, it's not legal or professional, Prof. But I think it's something that we might actually have to do. Let me take that best, and I'm not sure if there are other comments, so that we can continue, Prof. I see Cuthbert, Mulder, okay, in that order, and then we come back to...
Thanks, Chair. The first point I'd like to make is that it's all fine and well that we say we want investment, but we require labour-intensive investment, not capital-intensive investment, because we need investment that creates jobs. Because what we find is maybe an investment in services, and particularly within, finance, but that doesn't create the masses of jobs that we require. So I think it's important that we add a caveat to say that it should in fact be job creating investment that we should seek. It doesn't help to say there's a company from Germany that's going to invest 50 billion rand in our country, and they bring their own people in, and those are the people who are, serviced in terms of jobs. We need large-scale manufacturing, and I think it's important that we prioritize that in our country, and I don't believe that we are necessarily doing that. The second point I wanted to make is, in your guys' research, have you found the matching of goods that other countries we do not supply to within Africa require? Because we are slowly but surely losing pace with the developed world. However, there are many countries in Africa that are far behind us, as you've earlier mentioned. Are there certain goods that at this moment in time, without talking about beneficiation and these kinds of things, that are open markets for us to actually import to, or shall I say export to? And what are those goods and where are those opportunities at this moment in time? Thank you.
Hola.
Chair, thank you. I'm quiet today. I'm observing. It's a very informative session, and I must thank the presenters for that. I won't be long. I just want to say the following. I think it's quite clear, and this is not a forum for talking politics, but that we as a portfolio committee for this specific committee has got a huge responsibility on us to oversee and to influence the growth of the economy, because this Department of Trade and Industry has got a huge role to play in growing the economy. But I must just make an observation, and you don't need to reply to it if you don't want. We've got some serious policy challenges which might pose threats to economic growth, which need to be relooked. And that's something that we can discuss at another forum, but as we continue the discussion, it's quite clear to me. Thank you, Chair.
I'll start and then I'll hand over to Professor Athens. I think Honourable Member Cuthbert, if I have that correctly, you're absolutely right. Just to look at the metrics of foreign direct investment will not necessarily give us the answers we want. At the end of the day, it is the quality of investment that we've got to look at, and we've got to define what we mean by that. And the quality of investment will definitely have to reference the kind of jobs and the number of jobs we create. How that investment is connected to other businesses. Are they sourcing inputs from other businesses? Are they export-oriented, or are they looking at the domestic market? So there are a lot of questions around the quality of investment that we have to look at. And this is just talking about foreign direct investment, never mind the portfolio investment discussion, because that's a different one. But the reality is that even foreign direct investment, which used to take a very long time frame, so if you had an investor who came to set up a t-shirt factory in your country, we used to, 20, 30, 40 years ago, be able to count that investor would stay here for the long term. That's no longer the case. Clothing factories, t-shirt factories can be packed up overnight. So the mobility of even foreign direct investment poses significant challenges to us. So we want to know how, what investors, what quality investment would actually require for them to stay here, to make a long-term commitment, to create long-term sustainable employment and income-generating opportunities. So the discussion around investment, I think, is an extremely critical one. And it is also a focal point, of course, for this portfolio committee, but it's also one for the finance committee and many others that really have to focus on this point. So the quality of investment is certainly an absolutely critical one that we do have to have a look at. Your question about what opportunities do we have in the rest of Africa, and the opportunities we have in the rest of Africa are really across all sectors of the economy. I mentioned briefly that we've seen in recent years, for example, our export of apples increased to Japan. But in the case of African markets, apple exports have grown as fast. So when we take a look at the collection of agricultural products, there are significant opportunities. We also have, in many parts of the country, a fast-developing agro-processing industry. And again, there are a lot of opportunities in terms of exports, because many African countries have not yet reached that kind of level of development, and they're importing processed agricultural products from the rest of the world, from the European Union, increasingly also from China, but also from the United States. So that is a collection that we've got to look at. When we look at the manufacturing sector, there are again a number of areas that we can have a look at. And if we take a look at the developing automotive value chain across the continent, the fact that we now have in Nigeria, Morocco, Rwanda, and also Namibia, there's a market for components, for parts, for after-sales service, and a whole range of things there that we could actually exploit much more effectively.
So those are just some of the examples. But I would like to emphasize that when it comes to trade and services, South Africa has expertise, knowledge and experience across so many sectors that we are not capitalizing on enough. And a really interesting one, for example, is mining services. South Africa has a very, very long history in mining. Not only gold mining, but diamonds and a bunch of other platinum, manganese and so on. And if we look at what is happening in the mining sector across the continent, we do see mining engineers and experts across the continent, but there's a lot more we can do there. Construction, another really important services sector where across the continent with the boom in construction. I was in Niamey and Niger in July at the extraordinary summit of the African Union. My goodness, there are Turkish companies that are building hotels across that West African part of the continent. Where are the South African construction companies? Why have they pushed us out of those markets? What is happening in terms of the newcomers? So when we look at construction and infrastructure development, China's extremely prominent on the African continent, whether it's roads, railways, airports, and so on. But they've run into difficulties in some countries like Botswana, where Chinese company building the airport was actually kicked out. But the Turkish companies are coming into the construction industry. So there are a lot of opportunities that we've got to look at, but I don't think we should just think in terms of trade and goods. The trade and services sectors offer an enormous amount of opportunity. The ICT sector, we have clusters of coding experts, for example, the ICT clusters and incubators across South Africa. Cape Town is now recognized as one of the hubs for innovation and ICT globally. So it's in the company of Silicon Valley, India, and a number of others. Why are we not using that? And I think that's really important to keep in mind. So, but that analysis is critical. We really have to look at where the opportunities are and what we do to support those companies to be aware of the opportunities that exist and what it takes to operate on the continent.
Yeah, that slide maybe emphasized another point, and the chair has suggested that, if I understand you correctly, one of the implications of what you have said earlier is it is to our benefit that we have a prosperous, stable, and growing, and well-developing region. Not only because it makes sense in terms of stability, and the more stable they are, the more more attractive their markets will be. So the implications, the overlapping implications of trade, development, regional integration is a complex where we will have to understand that we are all in the same boat. Trudy mentioned the Peugeot car company investing in a plant, a plant. It's not because it wants to sell its cars in Namibia. It's because it wants to sell its car in Africa. So being regional integration has the implication that it also impacts on investment decisions in a dynamic sense, because you're not going to produce or assemble your Peugeot cars only to sell them in Bantam. They're meant to be sold all over Africa, including a discount. And there's nothing wrong with that. It is the mutual benefit. It's the logic of regional integration. It is the logic of a stable continent. And then the other implication here is the left hand must know what the right hand is doing. Unfortunately, we cannot pick and choose investors in the sense that you can only come and invest in my country if you create so many, many, many jobs in manual and sense that we traditionally understand, because then they won't come. And if you tell us, but okay, if they subsequently apply for a visa for a manager or engineer and the Department of Home Affairs, the immigration officials, do not allow them a permit, it didn't or doesn't allow them to come into the country, then they'll exercise to refute it. If there's one area where I think this portfolio committee can expand its antennae, its area of investigation, is do our left hands know what the right hands are doing in this country? We can entertain you with very unfortunate stories about our own experience in not being able to get people to come and attend our workshops because our Home Affairs officials in other countries in Africa don't give them the visas. So what we see here, and we are going to run through it very quickly, is that there is an active set of activities going on, and all the governments in Africa now have the, and this is a very important political development, the fact that the African Union sees integration, sees the African Continental Free Trade Agreement for the first time as a flagship program, has moved the debate about trade and integration in Africa to a very high political level. Mm. It was not the case before. There's a lot of unrealistic and overambitious hype about the Continental Free Trade Area. The fact that it is in force, but you cannot start trading under it, is an indication of that. But do not underestimate the political legitimacy that comes with this exercise. And that could be a game changer to some extent. Trudy, do you want to say something about the tripartite?
Perhaps just very briefly, of course, the Continental Free Trade Area is not the only set of negotiations that we are involved in on the African continent. The Tripartite Free Trade Area, which is really an initiative by 26 member states in Eastern and Southern Africa, those belonging to SADC, the East African Community, and the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa, have been involved in these negotiations since 2011. In 2008, heads of state decided that we should establish a tripartite free trade area, and the negotiations duly began in 2011. What we have now is a situation where the ongoing negotiations are two sets that we've got to focus on. SAPU, East African Community, and we've been informed that the tariff negotiations were completed in July. SAPU, South Africa, was also negotiating with Egypt, but there hasn't been any progress in recent years. So it really is in the tripartite free trade area, SAPU EAC. And of course there for South Africa, Kenya is the interesting market, a growing market, a big market, a lot of opportunities for us there. We know some freight forwarders that are involved in the export of furniture made in South Africa to Kenya, to a lot of resorts on the coast and so on. The current duty, before this enters into force, on furniture, tables and chairs in particular, is 25%. That's a barrier for us.
Mm.
So hopefully, we haven't seen what DTI has negotiated, hopefully that tariff has come down, because that would make our goods cheaper in the Kenyan market and provide good opportunities. So very important there. Keep in mind that SADC, EAC and COMESA are not going to disappear. SADC will continue to trade under the trade protocol. The EAC will continue, and according to its trade regime, the customs union and the common market, and the COMESA free trade area continues. That's really important. But this agreement is not entered into force. 14 ratifications are required. 5 member states have now ratified. But it's the same story, honourable members, as it is with the CFTA. The negotiations are not complete, and countries, member states, are ratifying the agreement. So it's the same formula that we are following in the AFCFTA. There are also programs on industrial development, infrastructure development, and trade facilitation. These are so important because they also support the development of the region, they lower the cost of doing business and so on, so they help trade in many, many different ways.
But the layered effect?
Sorry?
The layered effect, because you're saying those agreements remain, and then you have a continental one, so what is the effect of that? Does it assist? Does it make increase the difficulty to trade?
Yeah.
What do you
think? I think it will create difficulty.
it does create some difficulties, because one of the problems in African integration is that the regional economic communities, membership of regional economic communities overlaps. So for example, if we have a company in South Africa that is producing chairs to export to Kenya, they would have to comply with the rules of origin from this agreement once it enters into force. But if they are exporting to Zimbabwe, then it would be the SADC rules of origin and the tariffs that would apply. And if they are exporting to Namibia, then we're in the customs union and there are no rules of origin and there are no import duties. So it can be the same factory, but it's got to comply with different rules depending on where it's exporting to. It becomes complicated for business. So we're adding some complexity. That's very, very true.
It is.
This is a transport and trade facilitation program that the member states in the tripartite region have adopted. They've really been working on trade facilitation issues. And keep in mind, of course, honorable members, that we are also a signatory. We are party to the World Trade Organization Trade Facilitation Agreement, which entered into force in February 2017. So there are a lot of initiatives to address trade facilitation issues. And we've again got to see, are they working together? Are they making things simpler? Are they improving the environment for doing business and trade? Very, very important. This is the border post picture that I told you about. This is messy. You see some tankers there. Mm. That could be chemicals.
Mm.
They're in this queue, not even a queue.
Mm.
This does not help trade.
So let's say 40 kilometers.
Yes.
Cube.
At some point, 40 kilometers. Sure. Some spend 4 days, 7 days in a queue.
Okay.
Between DRC and Zambia.
What one was actually thinking, the big part, remember we have rail, we've got roads, we've got actually the travel as one part. I'm not sure, because we did actually have some basic infrastructure over here for those who are actually coming south, and there was actually infrastructure over time. So how are we doing in getting the balance in terms of because the value of a commodity might actually make business sense to actually look at other options as well, besides only roads. Rail might be a bit slower. Air traffic might be actually a bit better. So investing in those areas to move products might actually be one point which is very strategic.
That is important. Different goods may be better suited to different modes of transport. So for example, if we are packaging beautiful green beans in a packet, that's better to go air freight than it is to go by truck. If you are exporting fish, for example, I would not send it by road to wait 4 days there. This would be a disaster. But then other low-value, high-weight products, it's better to send them by road, but even better to send them by rail. But we don't have such an extensive rail network yet. And also, when it comes to transport modalities, we've got to keep in mind that the regulations are important. So even with road transport, you see some of these trucks, they are different size containers and loads. And that is because the axle load limit can be different from one country to another. So in some countries you can carry 40 tons, in others only 30 tons. So that impacts on efficiency of packaging and of transport. And in railways, you've got to have the same gauge railway line. Otherwise, things also don't work out so well. So these are really, really important issues to have a look at.
Can I just add to that picture of the taxes that are later? The interrelatedness of the various challenges is probably the central message that we are discovering through this discussion. We had to provide a trade facilitation workshop for a certain audience, freight forwarders and government institutions a month ago. And someone
participating there who is involved in the Zimbabwe structures of how the freight forwarders organize themselves, told us that day that apparently the week before, that was 2 months ago, there was for 8 hours a power cut at Baitbridge.
Mm.
No electricity. The knock-on effect of that was delays for several days.
Mm.
Now, where does the electricity come from?
South Africa.
Yeah, and we know how complicated that is. Okay, so that we are all in the same boat.
Mm. Mm.
If our borders are congested, if this is the reality, then of course we're going backward. And then if we have, in addition to that, the support service and, for example, energy, not there, and the commitment to modernize and to speed up the facilities to get IT involved in there, it is for other political reasons very, very difficult to do the right things at borders. Why? The story about the different rules that apply to trucks and transport. There are certain borders, our borders, the borders of our country, where as a result of union policies, the drivers have to get out when they come from overseas country and be replaced by others, or things must be moved, or you're not allowed to exploit the reality of one single integrated geographical area. There are serious problems to be looked at. We say that socio-economically we are integrated, politically we are not. Borders are very serious obstacles, and they have become battlefields for some of our own problems that are impacting on another set of objectives, which is regional integration and trade. So the anomaly is we have to trade in order to grow and in order to have more local jobs and in order to grow domestically, but at the same time there are forces at work that undermines or prevent that logic to be fully implemented. So the interrelatedness, the complications in your task ahead. I hope we have succeeded in making it more difficult for you.
Well, the point, the success, one wants to confirm the success to say we have actually given us moving of products as a big opportunity for business. That's what we have done. Because I think on my part, the challenge we identify is in line with where we can do better business and grow. Although actually for most of the tech, when energy is not there, you'd find that the other services get to be a challenge. Because in order to get water to different parts of where you want to supply, you need electricity to be able to pump water. So the strategic nature of what you have to look at as basic services for you to do business. This one is movement of products. And on the basis of that, I think looking at infrastructure and transportation is actually the next big business we can look at, because the trucks are stuck, which means we may have to look at alternatives and make them more viable moving forward. Okay. Unless there are further comments, and then we'll go. Okay, proceed.
Just one point about this border post. Honourable members, you may have heard about tradebarriers.org. Has anybody heard of this website? It's a web portal where anybody, including a truck driver who is stuck at this border, can notify a non-tariff barrier. So it's a program that was started some years ago by SADC, EAC and CAMESA, and we are now going to have a similar non-tariff-barriers.org at the AFCFTA. But let's just think how that works. So if I'm a truck driver and I'm stuck here at the border, I can go onto a website and I can lay a complaint and say, I'm stuck at the border and I've been here for X number of days and the queue isn't moving. and then somebody will receive my email, my notification that I put into the website, and they will say, okay, what kind of problem is this? Customs and Border Management, we need to contact the Customs Authority and DRC, and we'll contact them to try and resolve the problem. But Chair, as you say, when there is no electricity, there is no Wi-Fi, then that facility doesn't work. So we come back to basics that are actually prerequisites for us to start resolving some of these problems. There are many other problems related with resolving non-tariff barriers, which if we have time we can speak to. But let's move on. This is my favorite slide.
I call it a cartoon.
It's not a cartoon. This is the fabric of Africa, and it's diverse, and it's interesting, and there are a lot of opportunities. So, honourable members, this is entry into force of the AFCFTA on the 30th of May this year, as Professor Rasmus explained to us earlier. We all know the story of the AFCFTA, 50 member states of the African Union negotiating a lot of objectives. One of them is to boost intra-Africa trade, leverage investment, industrial development, and so on.
So they're counting Saudi, the Western Sahara.
Yes. It's 55 member states. 54 have now signed the agreement. Only Eritrea has not signed. But 27, see if we've got, here's our barometer. This is from the Trello website, which tells you which ones have now signed. 54, only Eritrea has not. 27 have ratified. We needed 22 for the entry into force. And you can get details of the countries. I didn't put that slide in here. But that's the status where we are. But we are still negotiating tariffs, rules of origin, and for trade and services. We forgot to put this in here, the sector commitment. Then phase two on intellectual property, investment, and competition policy are about to start. So we've got quite a lot of work ahead of us as far as this negotiations of concern.
What is Eritrea's impediment to signing?
They've had a lot of political peace security challenges, so they have not been focused on the AFCFTA just yet. And this is just, perhaps we can skip this a little bit. The question is, when can we start trading under the African Continental Free Trade Area? And what we are looking at now is that by mid-year next year, we want to have completed the tariff negotiations and rules of origin negotiations and actually implemented the changes to the tariff books, have authorities that are issuing rules of origin certificates to be able to start trading. It may be too ambitious for all of that to have happened by then, because it is a lot of work that needs to be done, not only in the negotiations, but in the implementation when we come home. So a lot of work needs to be done there. When it comes to services, there are five priority services sectors: financial services, communication, transport, tourism, and professional services. We have to now negotiate specific sector commitments. So it's now for our negotiators to identify, with the help of South African industry and the services sector, to say, you know what, if we look at the Ethiopian market, at the beginning of this year, Standard Bank opened a branch there. But there's so many domestic regulations that are problematic for us to really establish more banks there. Let's put that on the negotiation agenda, and we request Ethiopia to amend some regulations. So this request and offer process is how the negotiations on the sector commitments are going to take place. But you can imagine, honourable members, how time-consuming that is, and all the homework we've got to do before we can identify what we want to negotiate about. And Professor Rasmus's point about data is even more of a problem when it comes to services. We don't have good data on trade and services. So I think this is a major, major constraint there. So there's a lot of challenges awaiting there. But at the same time, we should be preparing for phase two of the negotiations on investment, competition policy, and intellectual property, so very important. The one thing we should keep in mind is that the regional economic communities continue. So Honorable Herman, I've just elevated him to an honorable member, ladies and gentlemen, sorry about that. But as you've mentioned before, the same problem arises here. The existing regional economic communities continue. So the question is, who are we going to negotiate with? We're not going to negotiate with anyone in SADC or anyone in SACU. And now we're not going to negotiate with EAC because we've done that in the tripartite. So we are going to be negotiating with countries in West Africa, North Africa, Ethiopia, and some other countries. So that list of who we're going to negotiate with is really, really important at this stage for us to have a look at.
Yeah. What institutions will the AFC-FTA have? Let's pause there for a moment, because if we are creating this new reality, and we say it's going to be rules-based, or we hope it will be rules-based, who will monitor compliance, and who will report on compliance, and who will ensure that the rules are being respected? Now, there is an annex, there is a protocol already concluded on dispute settlement. And, honourable members, that was the easiest one to conclude.
Wow.
Chop, chop. Why is it so easy? There's not a single example of an African government ever litigating against another African government for non-compliance with the trade agreement. Not one single case.
What if it happens now in this arrangement?
It would be wonderful news. It would be fantastic. But I will not bet my money on it. But I will not bet my money on it. I will not bet my money on it. The other qualification, of course, is that although trade disputes are primarily about the implementation or the interpretation of trade agreements and therefore between the state parties, the affected parties are private entities. If my poultry cannot be exported, I want a remedy. And what we're starting to see in the rest of the world, well, let's answer this question. Why have there been more than 400 disputes in the WTO between states? It's because those governments take the concerns of their private players, private sector, seriously, and they litigate on their behalf. Yeah, and the majority. So dispute settlement, still a complicated issue here. So it is true that we have a protocol of dispute settlement and we have annexes, but unlike the tribunal in the EAC or in ECOWAS or in COMESA, that dispute settlement body of the African Continental Free Trade Area will not allow private parties to have standing. We will have to go to our governments and ask our governments, and I will bet my last dollar that there will not be a sudden upsurge in trade disputes in my lifetime, and I'm not planning to go somewhere else soon. So I'm a little bit cynical about that one. But that it can be rules-based and must be rules-based can be enforced through the institutions. So let's look at the institutions. Now, the African Continental Free Trade Area creates only one new institution, and that's the Secretariat, which will be based in Accra in Ghana. But the highest body of the African Continental Free Trade Area is the AU Council. Not a new body, it's an existing body. What does that tell us? That tells us that this arrangement has a definite political dimension to it. It is a flagship program of the African Union. Now, the African Union Council is not continuously sitting, so it will operate through two other bodies that they will establish, and that's a Council of Ministers and a Committee of Senior Trade Officials. So let's see what's going to happen here. But I would say that the institutional dimension of regional trade arrangements is vitally important.
not only for the political oversight, that's the easy part, or for the disputes. You can solve your disputes through consultations. You can, if you're committed. But complying with the standards, disseminating the information. If traders and investors and importers and exporters want to know what are the rules with respect to the tariffs and the standards and the rules of origin, if I want to take my furniture manufactured here in Malmesbury and I want to sell it in a new casino somewhere in Central Africa or in a, on the coast in Kenya, what are the procedures? Where do I obtain that information? Those are the vital instruments. So, big, high-level institution, but these practical ones that will have to come in the wake of this one on specific issues, on standards, on rules of origin, on trade remedies, ad hoc bodies. That is where we will have to see what happens. And it's still a work in progress.
We will allow you to round up, because you've done very well. And on our part, we'll actually just wait for the kind of, you know, very important things to consider and to note, so that when we really continue with our discussion, because it's possible, we actually start where we end off today. So the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you so much, Honourable Members. It's been a really interesting morning to spend with you. I would like to just alert you to some of the information in this small booklet. So Professor Rasmus was talking about institutions. This is page 6 and 7 in the small booklet. I think just to conclude, Honourable Members, we are committed. We want the AFCFTA to work. I think when we have a discussion like this, we see what an ambitious and comprehensive and difficult task we as member states have embarked on in Africa, but we believe that it is absolutely essential, and we really want this to work. And so our continuing work on these issues, sometimes we are in tight corners because the challenges are complex, they're difficult. But we want to resolve the issues. We want to contribute to a productive discussion, to building capacity to make trade work for Africa's development. So we're committed to work with you. If you would like to see us again, we'd be very happy to come and join you again. And if you have any questions, and I think, Chair, we'd like to make that available to all committee members. If you have any specific questions related to this African trade integration agenda, to the CFTA, the tripartite, SOC, USADC, then please do contact us. We'd be very happy to help you. We haven't had time to say anything about the Brexit and SADC EFA, which was our last slide, but again, we're watching to see what happens this week at the Supreme Court in London, and then we're watching the 31st of October with even bigger eyes. And again, if there are any questions from members or we can assist with any background material, please do let us know. So it's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
No, Prof?
No, I know my place.
You've got the box.
Well, the point is that there was actually a proposal that you be adopted as a member by your colleague. But I would say
that's not the stuff we're trying to get rid of me.
Okay. No, can we then conclude our session? But I think this was quite informative. But on the other side, I think the flip side from my point of view that all the challenges, particularly a good example of the movement of products, is actually an eye-opener, but I see huge opportunities on that as one point, because without infrastructure, without actually, movement of products, we stuck. We can't actually get anywhere. But thanks very much, and most appreciated. Next time we invite you, I'm sure you'll be able to come through. And we were quite happy with the engagement and discussion we had today. Thank you very much. Okay. So maybe we'll conclude our session as well as the committee, unless there are issues, Secretariat.
Not from our side, Chair. We've discussed all the issues this morning already, so...
Thank you very much. Morgan?
Chair, no, please. I just want to suggest that we all go for counselling afterwards.
Yes.
We offer no services.
Thank you very much, Baba Morgan. We really need something to help us. The meeting is adjourned.